And then this guy named Dwight.
Going to call the committee, the House Committee on Healthcare, House Interim Committee on Healthcare to order for this lovely sunny day outside. Any of you want to take time out to go to the beach or something? I recommend it. In the meantime, we'll do some work here. We have a pretty tight schedule. I'm going to ask folks to say the time frames they've been given. We'll end up introducing a few legislative concepts as committee bills by the time we're done. So we need to make sure we keep a quorum. People are sort of busy today with things going hither and yon. We're going to start with the Oregon Health Authority report. You've got 45 minutes to manage it tightly. Madam Administrator. She's calling the team off the bench.
Yeah.
All hands on deck.
Is Dwight here with you today?
He's parking.
Okay.
And you know the drill. Please introduce yourself.
Sir. Good morning. I'm Lynn.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I need to open an information meeting, right? I'm sorry. Okay. We're opening an information meeting. Now you got it.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Noce. I'm Lynn Saxton, the Director of the Oregon Health Authority, and with me today is Royce Boland, who is the new Behavioral Health Director for the Oregon Health Authority. We're very pleased to have Royce on board. We did a national search and took about a year and hired the hometown kid, or gentleman, and he has we're particularly enjoying working together. Royce's professional career has been spent working with adults with severe behavioral health issues, and so that's a welcome addition to our team, which includes a lot of people experienced with the children's behavioral health system. Also, good morning. We have with us this morning Dwight Holton from Lines for Life, and we're going to give you an update on the Behavioral Health Collaborative and our efforts to develop a 21st century behavioral health plan for Oregonians. So I think, Royce, you're going to go first.
Yeah. Good morning, Chair Greenlake and Vice Chair Noce and members of the committee.
Got two vice chairs up there. Too.
Yeah.
One more time.
Okay.
I am so sorry. Thank you. I'm getting the etiquette part down. My apologies.
You got the name of the most important one.
Yeah.
For the record, my name is Royce Boland, and as Lynn indicated, I am the new Behavioral Health Director for Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to provide you with an update on the work from the Behavioral Health Collaborative. The collaborative began back in July. We've had 9 meetings so far, with our next meeting happening this Wednesday. During the course of early in the meetings, the agency provided context and information that allowed everyone to be on the same page, since there are varying experience levels within the group. So essentially, we leveled the playing field. The agency put forth some straw proposals in the third meeting, which really got attention, and it also resulted in the full engagement from the members. We then divided up into 6 work groups, the first work group being data, the second being payment reform and finance, the third being workforce, the fourth being outcomes, fifth, waste and efficiencies, and 6, scope of responsibilities. These groups worked together for 4 weeks and each put forth a set of recommendations pertaining to their focus area. The agency is working fast and furiously to braid these 6 recommendations into a cohesive set that the group can agree on. We worked all day Friday and over the weekend to come up with a second draft document that we think people will be happy with. The process has been focused on being inclusive, with the goal being that whatever product is put forth, it truly represents the work by the collaborative and that is recognizable as the collaborative's work. We want the members to have ownership in the product so they are motivated to implement it. I have a unique perspective as I began working with the collaborative as an outside partner. In my previous capacity, I was the president of the Oregon Residential Provider Association. I have both provided mental health and addiction services in a variety of settings over the last 22 years in Oregon, as both a clinician and as an administrator, and have seen the many changes in services throughout the 22 years. As a provider, I can tell you about the need for a system change. We've made huge strides in physical care. Now it's time to focus on integration of both physical and behavioral health. This requires a significant change in how our existing system currently functions. Since joining Oregon Health Authority on November 14th and working on the collaborative from the inside, I've continued to see an incredible amount of interest and motivation to take the next step at improving our system through true system integration, creating a system that serves the whole person and improves their lives. The collaborative has coalesced around some general themes: prevention and education, the social determinants of health, and trauma-informed care models. Building on existing successes and spreading successful models, sharing risk, reducing waste, and improving efficiencies, integration. I've really seen that the physical health has done an incredible job. It's really now time for behavioral health and them to partner, because I think that we can make some, huge strides around that. While these themes are broad, the recommendations will be a little bit more specific, but not specific enough to launch into implementation. There will be more work ahead to break down each one of these into action items. There will also be more work groups as a result. With a problem this complex, with this many moving parts, there is no simple solution. However, the Oregon Health Authority is committed to implementing these changes. They must happen to create a 21st century health system that integrates behavioral health and works for all Oregonians who depend on it. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to take questions at this point?
Well, I think we need to...
Oh, I'm sorry, forgot. Again, etiquette. I was supposed to introduce Dwight to talk more about the process. My apologies.
My suggestion is that we hold the question. We're going to have, I mean, this I see as an introduction for us. We're going to have in-depth time when we get back in session, but there will be time for a few questions. You want to start now?
In working with some people, I had a question, and I just... This might be a good time to ask. I guess I was, Mr. Bulla, and I was looking in your 21st Century Behavioral Health Action Plan report and recommendations. Mm-hmm. And on page 15, the following statement was made: included in the OHA-CCO contract mandated language of a guaranteed service benefit of, quote, peer support services to be available and offered to all individuals who are receiving behavioral health services treatment in the Oregon system. And I guess the question that I had is, what is OHA's commitment to fulfilling this peer support services contract language recommendation in this behavioral collaborative action? Sorry to make it so complicated, but it was very specific, and I thought it was a good question to ask.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose, Vice Chair Hayden, Representative Kenemer, thank you for the question. This is a draft report at this point. Mm-hmm. And although it is the agency's intention to use both our contracting authority through the CCO contracts, which is a separate set of statutes from our contracting authority for community mental health programs, and we intend to use both authorities in an effective way to integrate services better, we do anticipate incorporating peer support services, peer-delivered services in the strategic plan. Exactly how that will occur and where it will occur in the language and the rules and contracts is not yet determined, and we'll be looking at that. I think we've had very compelling testimony in the collaborative from consumers that often the person they reach out for the most is one of their peers who is trained and is available to them on a 24/7 basis. So we're very committed to the model. At this point, we're still haven't defined how it's going to be incorporated in the go-forward model, but it certainly will be in an effective manner.
Great. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is a general question. We're talking about a mental health system not only for the Medicaid patients, but for the population.
Correct. We're talking about the safety net system provided by the counties as well as the Medicaid system and other recipients of care.
Great.
Good morning, Chair Greenlick. My name is Dwight Holton, with your leave. Delighted to be here. I'm the Executive Director of Lines for Life, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, and Vice Chair Nose. I'm a proud constituent of Vice Chair Nose. I'm delighted to have been a part of this behavioral health collaborative process. As I think probably all of you know, I come at this from a slightly different angle, having spent 15 years in law enforcement before taking the helm of Lines for Life. In that time in law enforcement, one of my key lessons of the 450 people I prosecuted personally and the thousands whose prosecutions I supervised, almost every one of those stories that ended in federal criminal court began with untreated mental health or substance abuse issues somewhere back in time, whether for the defendant or for a family member that drove a profit motive around many of the white-collar cases that I prosecuted. I am therefore really enjoyed this process, and I see it as a culmination of efforts by Director Saxton and those before her and many of the people here on the committee and in the room to put behavioral health on the same footing as physical health in Oregon. There can be no doubt that if you're looking for fertile ground in which we can better serve Oregonians and do so more cost-effectively by addressing challenges up front to prevent costs, both personal and family and budgetary down the road, there's no more fertile ground than in behavioral health. The collection of folks that Director Saxton and others assembled for the Behavioral Health Collaborative was a all-star squad of behavioral health, substance use disorder, and prevention experts from around the state. So I was really very pleased to be a part of it. As a relative newcomer, I felt like I was learning something every time anyone spoke in the room, and that was helpful. As Director Saxton mentions, this was the culmination of a long process that included listening sessions, followed by the assembly of this all-star team. I think the recommendations are evolving, but evolving in a really very positive way to make significant structural change that will realize that some of that potential of better serving Oregonians up front. I'd emphasize three kind of core themes that I think are prominent in the report. First is the notion of prevention, near and dear to my heart, as I said, from my background both in law enforcement and my time at Lines for Life. The document emphasizes the importance of prevention as an opportunity to meet and serve people before they get into the system and prevent them from ever ending up in the system and the victimization and challenges that happen along the way if they do. Second, the importance of substance use disorder treatment as a key component of behavioral health. There can be no doubt that that's fertile ground. The better we do with substance use disorder treatment, and we are learning more and more, the science is getting better and better, the more effectively we can improve Oregonians' lives without having them have to go through substantial both costs, physical, personal, and budgetary. And finally, the importance of integration. I heard Dr. Amit Shah, the medical director of CARE Oregon, once say that we will achieve better behavioral health only when we are fully integrating both ways, behavioral health into physical health and physical health into behavioral health. I think that's right. I think we can do better there. The document is the recommendations are intended both to achieve integration in payments, but also integration in metrics and objectives. If you integrate payment without creating behavioral health metrics to match, then all the money will go to physical health because that's where the metrics drive it. So it's incredibly important that we create metrics on the behavioral health and substance use disorder side. Finally, I'll just leave you with a thought from one of integration, by the way. As many of you know, we've been conducting opioid summits around the state at Lines for Life together in collaboration with CCOs, providers, law enforcement, treatment professionals, preventions. Integration has been the elephant in the room at every one of those summits. It's been the key conclusion that we'll do better on the opioid crisis the better we integrate behavioral and physical health. I'll leave you with the thoughts of a doctor who a primary care provider who came up to me at our summit in Seaside and said, you know, if we reimbursed for substance use disorder the way we do for orthopedics, we would not have access or quality problems that we do. I think that reflects that kind of inspiration towards integration that really ought to be at the heart of this report and is.
Ben, I'm going to ask you to, if you will, do something unusual in this case. When the report comes out, it would be very helpful if you briefed individually every member of the committee.
I'd be happy to do that.
Between now and February.
Yes.
You have until February to do that. But and you'll know we'll have at least one change. We have one vacancy in the committee, so we keep an eye on who's in. Because we're going to obviously spend some time on it as we get into the
Look forward to that.
February session. It would be helpful if we're all a little bit ahead of the game. Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all for
already 2 minutes over
presentation. I want to support Representative Kenner's question on peer support services. I've heard a lot about this since digging into this issue. And one of the things that I'm working on, I know you're looking at the whole chain from prevention to crisis care to step-down service in the community. And we had a bill last year that the Hospital Association did a fantastic job on that asked them to go back and look at create discharge plans for hospitals. Mm. And originally we wanted it for anyone that showed up in an emergency room or acute crisis center. And we ended up just doing the piece of emergency rooms that had the capacity to actually accept, that had residential beds and could accept people, admit people. And now we're trying to get to the next stage. And one of the things that we're hearing about a lot of the rural hospitals, and I'm hoping you're going to help me work on this, is that if you don't admit, they often don't even have licensed mental health professionals in the hospital, in the emergency rooms in some of these A and B hospitals. And so there's no one there that can do a suicide risk assessment or anything. And then there's often no place that you can even refer people that's anywhere, you know, within close driving distance. So we're trying to tackle that piece. We're saying, what is the, you know, there's no parity, because if you come in with a heart attack, they're not going to release. Yeah, so I'm just wondering how you are, how you're addressing that. And I want to make sure that when we have our one-on-one presentations from you, when the report fully comes out, love to dig more into that issue. So if there's anything you want to just say about that. I skimmed the report. I didn't see anything specific about it. I'm wondering if you're tackling that.
Chair Greenlick, co-chairs, we are addressing that through two tools that we've developed. One is the behavioral health mapping tool that we began developing in 2015 that shows the gaps in resources geographically for the state, both financial and service continuum. And second, we're looking at, Oregon has the 14th highest suicide rate in the country, and so we're looking through the lens both in public health and in Medicaid health of suicide across the board and where are the gaps in services and where do we need to build that capacity. That is, in fact, part of what will grow out of the collaborative report, is taking the data and the system as it is and allocating resources to areas where there are tremendous gaps in care. So we'll be addressing it in that way, and we'll look forward to reporting to you further when we meet with you.
And Chair Greenlick, if I could add, there's very strong data from SAMHSA to suggest that a program of scheduled follow-up calls to people who've been in the emergency room with behavioral health challenges over a 24-hour, 10- and 30-day period results in significantly better outcomes and significantly reduced costs. Yeah. So we have a grant to do that currently with Providence Portland, and we'd love to be doing it more broadly. Headlines for Life.
And that was a part of our discharge planning, that the recommendation be that a follow-up call is done within 7 days. And I know for suicide, the recommendation is 48 hours. But there's no capacity in these rural hospitals to do any of that. So thank
you
for
working
on
it.
My only admonition as we move forward is, remember, what we're hoping for is a look at the whole community mental health system. It's easy to aim at the CCOs, and they're having their own integration problems. But I suspect that's a quarter of our population. The other three quarters are in all sorts of things, including private health insurance and no health insurance. Good.
Understood.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next topic?
Thank you, Chair. I'll excuse myself.
Thank you. Our next topic is enrollment and eligibility, and I'd ask Dr. Shahan to join us. Chair Greenlich and co-chairs, we are going to cover today. This is a slide deck.
No. Oops. Staff will help you.
That we're going to share with you a slide deck that we developed for a recent webinar with CCOs about the status of OHP enrollment and eligibility work. Part of, while we're getting queued up here, I want to share with you is we've been fortunate since the One Eligibility System stood up in December to have Dr. Shahan and her team working intensely to operationalize the technology that we adopted following Cover Oregon. And Dr. Shahan, who is an OBGYN but also happens to have a master's degree in computer science, I'm not quite sure how people accomplish all that in a lifetime, but I'm appreciative nonetheless, has spent a lot of time working on improving our eligibility processes. I do want to introduce this topic by saying that we knew when we stood up the One system in December that it was done quickly to respond to the crisis of Cover Oregon. And in standing up One, we stood up the core component of the Kentucky system. And other components are now added to improve our operations and our data. But we'd like to cover today a few things. First, we want to talk about the reason for the OHP enrollment decline this year. We'd like to talk about the impact the renewal process has had on that enrollment, what we're doing to reduce interruptions in coverage. Do you have a question? Is there a, do we have the right?
This is the enrollment page.
We're good?
Oh, yeah, please
okay.
Keep
okay,
going.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Don't let my confusion slow
okay.
me down.
And finally, I'd like to discuss when Oregon Health Plan enrollment will stabilize. My intent is to give you both an overview, but also to level set expectations. 2016 is the year where we take the data that was entered at the start of the implementation of the ACA in the Cover Oregon process, which was largely a paper process at the outset, and take that data and hand enter it into our new system. We did not intentionally roll the data over electronically because of our fear that the data was in a poor condition to start. So simply rolling it over would perpetuate the error rate in that data. So we have been clear from the outset that 2016 is our year to effectively improve the caliber of Oregon's data. This first slide we're going to show you is the Medicaid assistance caseload. The chart shows actual health plan enrollment from October 2013 to August 2016, which is the blue line. And it also shows, interestingly enough, the fall 2013 forecast of what we expected to occur with Medicaid expansion. That's that green line. We're going to look in the next slide. We're going to talk about the 17-19 time period, but right now we'd like to make a few observations about what you're seeing here. First of all, obviously, Medicaid expansion increased enrollment significantly by about 400,000 members. Again, the projections were that Medicaid expansion would increase enrollment in Oregon about 230,000. So we had almost double what we expected. We suspended, it's important to note, renewals following the failure of Cover Oregon. And this is something that I think a lot of people have lost in all the recent months. But this suspension of most renewals resulted in a caseload accumulation from January 2015 to March 2016. And since March, the number of enrollees has declined at a steep rate due to the resumption of renewals as we catch up those that were suspended during the transition from Cover Oregon to the One platform. For most members, this is a critical point, for most members who joined the Oregon Health Plan since December 2014, the recent re-enrollment period is the first time they have been asked to renew since they joined the Oregon Health Plan. So we're in an education process with our membership. Leading up to implementing the One system, we erred on the side of keeping people on Medicaid while we cleaned up significant issues with the quality and integrity of data in the Cover Oregon system. That was a policy decision we made to create a safety net for OHP members in the startup phase. It's important to underscore that the One system is not an immediate perfect solution. That was understood at the beginning when it was decided to adopt the Kinex system from Kentucky. Not all components were activated at startup to ensure that so that we could meet the launch date and the federal requirements for startup. So it's if you think of a component system, we implemented the core and now we have to build the components. The good news is that the implementation overall has gone smoothly, and it's important to note that 60 days after One launched in December, the Oregon Health Authority made the decision to bring KPMG on board, who has national expertise in these systems across the country, and also, in addition to helping us with our people and processes of implementation, was able to give us important benchmarking capacity to other states and where other states that expanded Medicaid were in their implementation of systems post-startup. So the good news is that Oregon had many struggles, but although we had many struggles, we have done much better than other states. The system changes are still underway. They're tricky, and there have been technical setbacks. Soon after we stood it up, we learned that we'd need to do a lot of work, not just to the technology being in place is the first step, but then you have to align all your business processes and all your people capacity to ensure that the implementation continues successfully. This effort has included, but is not limited to, working with outside consultants with expertise in call centers and optimization of our new system, contracting for additional call center resources and equipment to improve answer rates and wait times, and this includes improving the phone technology itself, which was insufficient. It includes prioritizing application processing for closure line calls, registering. We registered over 670 community partners statewide to assist with application processing, hiring more than 60 FTE temporary staff to help with the application processing, and finally collaborating closely with SEIU to ensure critical deadlines for the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services in Washington, D.C. were met. And those deadlines were achieved under Dr. Shahan's leadership. Since renewals resumed in March of 2016, Oregon Health Plan enrollment has declined from roughly 1.1 million people to about 1 million people as of November 21st, 2016. It's a 13% change. Notably, OHP enrollment remains approximately 377,700 members higher than in December 2013 when Medicaid expansion went into effect. We expected a decrease in the MAGI population, the financially eligible portion of the population, and we've seen that. We are, it's good to note, coming to the end of the post-Cover Oregon catch-up, and we expect enrollment will stabilize early next year. So let's go to that next slide. This shows the point of stabilization. It includes the spring 2016 forecast, And also shows where we expect to be in the coming biennium is about 1 million Medicaid members. That's 25% of the state. The state is now 4 million people, and reflects really. I know many of you saw it in the CCO quarterly report, but really the range of enrollment across the state varies greatly. We have a number of rural counties in particular where Medicaid enrollment is somewhere between 35% and 39% of the population of the county. Okay. I'm going to move on to discuss the forecasting efforts that we've made. As you all know, forecasting is an imperfect process, and it's easily influenced by changes in state and federal policy and obviously the economy. In the last 9 months, the Oregon Health Authority, in addition to its work to improve our eligibility system and its process, has put a lot of focus on improving the integrity and validity of our forecasts. That has included, first of all, a corrective effort to get the population into all the right categories as our data improved throughout 2016. It also has included what will be quarterly meetings with the CCOs to review their forecasting data and what they're seeing specifically in their forecasts that should inform and enhance the state's forecast. And finally, if we need to look for additional benchmarking forecasting capacity outside the state, we're open to that possibility. We haven't done that yet, but there are national services that provide amplifications to states' forecasts in this population area. We do have some anomalies in the data that we're seeing as a result of this increasing accuracy we've seen in 2016, and in the next 60 days, we will be meeting with the CCOs about the anomalies that they are seeing in their data.
And can I interrupt?
Yeah.
We're getting toward the end of the time. Yep. You have a table called Renewals for Converted Cases.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go to that?
Yeah. Is that it?
That's it.
It looks like 50% of the people you ask to enroll don't re-enroll. Is that?
So I'm going to have...
There's 500,000 people you sent out forms on, and 52% of them returned them. The other 48% didn't.
I want to talk first. Do you want to do this, or shall I? This is the converted case portion of the enrollment. So first...
It's a 500,000 people.
Right. But I want to be clear, it's not the whole population. It's 500,000 people. And yes, we call these converted cases are the original eligibility records that came from the Cover Oregon system. And under the old system, again, I want to remind people.
I just want to ask a question. Does it appear that in half of your population, half of the members didn't return a response? And yet you're only talking about a 10% reduction in population?
So, Representative Chair Greenleg and the co-chairs, it's actually 33% of population who does not return within 90 days. The 15% of that 500,000 population do return within 30 to 90 days by, again, continuous outreach and reaching out to them and sending them further information. These are the 15% who are still eligible, and as a safety net, the policy allows them to come back and get enrolled. So it's only the 33% population.
It's a third of your population didn't re-enroll.
Yes.
You have 100 million, 10, and if you expect a third of that population not to re-enroll, how are you projecting 1 million?
So this is actually, these members are 16% of the total Medicaid population.
550,000.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. It's 33% that didn't return within 90 days.
Half the population you sent out a form to, and a third of that half did not respond within 90 days. In other words, they haven't responded. So you're going to lose a third of that population. Is that not right? What am I missing here?
I think the part that... I'll go ahead. I think the part we're missing is first that the numbers were inflated during the period that we were not removing
people. Which numbers were inflated?
That the go back to the previous chart.
A million one.
So I'm going to use this chart.
To go back.
Does this one do it better than
I mean, I've looked at this data before. There isn't. You sent out forms to half the population, and a third of them didn't respond, have not yet responded, are not currently members. So if you've lost a third of half of the population, what do you expect to gain or lose with the other half?
We don't expect to lose a third with the other half. The numbers were artificially inflated when we were not moving people off, when we were just holding people onto Medicaid while our systems got caught up. And so I think the million reflects, if you take a million and 500,000 and it's 33% of the 500,000. I wish I had my
calculator.
That's right.
33% of the 500,000. That's what this table says.
184.
Right. So that's 184,000 of
is the 550
the population is 1.1 million. So, and I think our numbers showed that this is 16% of the total caseload.
Yes.
So, and I think we could.
You lost a third of this population, right?
Of the
550,000.
Yes.
So that's more. That's 180,000. That's more than you're predicting losing out of the whole population.
Correct.
You've already lost more. And that doesn't say what's going to happen when you renew the other half.
So, Chair Greenleg, this is again the 16% of the total Medicaid caseload, the numbers that you are seeing, the
50%.
16% of the total Medicaid caseload.
So.
But you only asked half of the population. You're going to have to ask the other half as well.
Right.
So, in half the population, you've lost 184,000. You're not predicting a total loss of 184,000 in those earlier slides, but you've already lost 184,000.
So
these numbers sound pretty specific to me. They're your table.
Let me do
the math.
The math.
Could I just ask what the
Representative Kinnemer first.
Mr. Chair, I wonder, if I understand correctly, there's also a gigantic backlog of cases, applications being processed. Is that where the slippage is occurring?
That's them. I mean, this is a specific look at half of the population.
Yes, it is, and I agree, but my understanding is there's a substantial backlog of applications
that
are not processed.
New applications?
Well, old and new, I guess. I'm sorry, I'm not quite up to speed on that, but I understand there's this huge backlog, and is that what accounts for the difference, because these are not processed?
Those are two separate issues.
Maybe I've only confused the matter. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I have a simple question.
I had a simple question.
It started out simple, but it got complex.
A dollar.
Can you just define the denominator here for me? What's the 551,000 and change? How was that selected?
Those are the converted cases from Cover Oregon. So, I will explain it in my terms, but why don't you go first and I'll follow up if it gets too technical. I think
Chair Greenleg, co-chairs, and Representative Brulich. So the 550.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the records, this is Varsha Chauhan, Chief Health Systems Officer for Oregon Health Authority. The 551,790 are the people between March and August who were due for renewals. Those were the people who were mailed the renewal letters during the time period, again, from March to August 2016.
So these are rolling numbers,
I
right?
See. Okay.
Okay.
That's right. Total population.
So.
It's half of the total population.
But could I ask one thing?
It's not the
Is it the expanded population? It's not the people on the subsidized exchange. You were talking about the OHP, just OHP?
That's just
It is the total caseload.
Yeah, for Oregon Health Plan.
Yes, it is the total caseload, which we call as the Medicaid assistance caseload. So it's everyone in that
it's
population.
It's half of the population, and a third of them are gone. So, now, the other half, we don't know what's going to be gone, but if this follows suit, we're going to lose a third of the rest of them as well.
I think what would be helpful here, let me see if this can work. We can give you a chart that shows the rolling renewals and the number of people renewed, the number of people dropping out, and the number of people adding in. Because the other thing we need to factor in here is members are, for example, we have over 8,000 members who are now entering through the applicant portal. They're not in this process, and they're upping the numbers. So I think on a continuous basis. So what we can do is build you a chart that shows the total population, that shows the rolling renewals, and we can answer which population they come from, because it's a process in movement all the time. And when I do the math, I come up with the 16% of the total Medicaid caseload. So there's something we're not communicating the
16%.
Visuals.
Yeah, you've got 33% of half of the population. That represents 16% of the total population.
Right.
But what happens when you ask the other half? Are you going to get the same 33%?
No, we don't.
How do you know that?
Well, our experience is that we aren't going to have that
happen.
This
is your only experience.
Well, I think
this experience tells you you are going to lose them.
I think we can show you a chart that will make this clearer than I can make it with these bits and pieces. I actually would tell you that the core Medicaid population has remained fairly stable, not the expansion population. The categorical population has remained fairly stable over time.
How do you know?
Because of our experience with that population over time. And I can show you that graphically. I don't have that chart here today.
Well, I think we're running out of time. We have other things to talk about. But I'm telling you, I believe you are in trouble. And I've looked at every chart that you've given me now. And I believe your projections are wrong. Now, the federal government might solve the problem by killing Medicaid, so we won't have to worry about it. But if they don't, I do not believe your projections are right. Or you have a big problem getting that 185,000 people back in the system if they're supposed to be.
Chair Green, look, I'm going to have Dr. Shahan respond. I understand your concern. We're just simply not seeing in any of our forecasting data those trend lines you're describing. And we're not seeing in an
I know that.
I know.
That's my problem, is that you're not recognizing you have a problem.
So, Chair, Representative Green, like Vice Chairs, the numbers that we are seeing here are only converted cases. The 551,790 is the population that we need to convert from the covered Oregon system into the one system. And that would get done. These all cases would get converted by end of February. That's the first renewal cycle. So they would not be a constant decrease. This is just the converted cases population. So it's not the other 500 and the other half million population. So we're just focusing on converted cases here.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, we will take another stab at it, and we appreciate your concern.
Representative Bueller, final comment on this.
Yeah. Are you, do these, I don't even want to call them members, are these people uniquely identified? Is there any chance that you have a duplication through the information processing struggles? Are these real people, or are they just, you know, people that have been enrolled through the website?
So, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs, it is possible there are duplications, and as we said in our testimony going back a year, 2016 is the year where we sort out the duplicates, where we put the families together in the right groupings, et cetera. That's part of the reason that the state selected the one system is its ability to do that. We still think there is error in this data. Our data will not, as Dr. Shahan said, get really tight until the end of February, the end of March. But we're on a path to increasingly accurate information and have been throughout the last year. I do want to just put in a footnote too that we look at all the enrollment data numbers on a weekly basis and follow trends of the volume of people, the number of people, the categories of people every single Monday morning. And again, I understand your concern that we're going to see some precipitous drop. We have not seen it yet, and we are closely watching for that if it should occur.
How many people do you have right now?
How many people do we have?
We have right at the moment.
We have 1,036,000.
And that does not include the 186,000 here?
That's correct.
So you had 1.1 million, you lost 200,000, and now you gain back 100,000.
That's why I need to show you a rolling number. We can't tie the numbers. This is a point, these are point in time numbers, and we're watching all those transactions across a time period. So we will put that together. I understand the frustration, but I can't tie these numbers because they're different time points in time.
All right, let's go to the next topic.
Okay.
And we'll take 10 minutes for the next topic, please.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're already out of time.
We're 15 minutes late already.
Yeah.
Okay. Ready? Okay. I'd like to introduce Katrina Hedberg, who is our Chief Medical Officer for the Public Health Division, and Dr. Jim Rickards, who is our Chief Medical Officer for Health Systems. And they're going to talk about opioids.
So Chair Greenlich and Vice Chair Nose, members of the committee, I'm Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the State Health Officer.
I'm Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
So thank you for the opportunity to talk to you all about opioids. I know we're running out of time, so I'll abbreviate. I think you all have copies of the slides. But I do want to start off with just this brief video clip here.
Sturgeon fish down there. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Story.
Oh. Is there sound? I'm sorry. Absent sound, it doesn't quite make the same impact. but the point is that this young man was actually a high school athlete. He had some injuries, started on prescription opioids, and then moved on to heroin before he died of a heroin overdose. And I show this. You all know that I love data, health data and statistics, but there are personal stories behind each one of the statistics. Again, I think I've presented to you all before about the numbers. Suffice it to say, we continue to have an opioid overdose problem in Oregon, much as the same as the rest of the country. So again, I think you have the data slides with you. But I wanted to, again, focus a little bit on what Oregon Health Authority has done related to opioid overdose. So I think about it in these categories, limiting the amount of opioids that are out there, the prescriptions, both the numbers that are prescribed, as well as offering alternative pain therapies. So again, that we're really talking about compassionate care for people with pain, promoting access both to naloxone rescue, as well as medication assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, and then again using data. So we're going to talk to you today about this first category and what we've been involved with around this. So in March, the Centers for Disease Control issued guidelines around prescribing of opioids. Again, the opioid epidemic has been seen around the country. And these are focused really on chronic, non-cancer, non-palliative, non-end-of-life pain. So we're really talking about chronic musculoskeletal or neuropathic pain. So the recommendations, and again, I won't go through all of these, but they're pretty extensive. There's a big, thick book. These were published or actually written by Dr. Roger Chow at the OHSU Center for Evidence-Based Practice, was one of the co-authors of this. And they're very, very useful. They did extensive review of the literature to come up with guidelines for appropriate prescribing of opioids. Again, when to use them and what alternatives to offer, what the selection should be, as well as continuing continuing to assess risks as well as addressing some of the harms with opioids. And really, a big focus of this was focusing on the patient's functional status. So again, we want people not to be in pain, but the point really is that we want to maintain or improve functions, and chronic opioids don't always do that. So shortly after this, we convened a task force in Oregon, really to review what the CDC guidelines had come up with and to see whether or not there were any additions we needed to do in Oregon. And the goal of the task force was really to set a standard across the state so that it wasn't certain health systems or certain providers that might have different standards, tamping down on opiates, if you will, and then patients going across the street and getting higher doses somewhere else. So folks on this task force really did want to provide this kind of level playing field for prescribing of opiates in states. So the membership included professional associations, licensing boards, provider organizations, as well as health systems, hospitals, payers, as well as there had been a number of regional task forces that had actually developed these types of guidelines even prior to the statewide work. Southern Oregon had done it, Central Oregon, the metropolitan area. So we really wanted to support those regional efforts and then again come up with statewide efforts. These were public meetings, and we did have public input as well. So the task force voted to endorse the CDC guideline as the foundation for prescribing, but then looked at some very specific areas. One involved marijuana use. Of course, we have medical marijuana, and now we also have retail marijuana in Oregon. And clinicians were wondering, if you have patients who are on very high doses of marijuana or THC or CBD for pain, what would that mean for opiate prescribing, as well as some other substantive issues, such as when patients transferred very high doses, transferred to a new provider, if the patient is above a guideline threshold, what to do about those. So we were really trying to provide guidance and sort of tools for providers to use. So the next steps, of course, involve communication, obviously to the providers themselves, but I think to patients, the public, policymakers, about what to expect when it comes to prescribing of opioids. And, of course, the real challenge, I'd say, writing these guidelines, especially because CDC had guidelines, writing them or endorsing them was the easy step. The much harder step is how do they get implemented across health systems and in different clinic settings, et cetera. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Rickards to talk a little bit about what OHA has done around back pain, alternative therapies for lower back pain.
So thank you. So the work that Katrina, Dr. Hedberg has been discussing really applies to all Oregonians, irregardless of the payer. In addition to this broader work, the OHA has also been addressing opioid issues specific to the Medicaid population. One of the areas in Medicaid in which we've historically seen a large amount of opioid prescribing and utilization is in the treatment of low back pain. In 2013, approximately 50,000 Medicaid members sought care for back pain. About 60% of these individuals received opioids to treat their back pain. These significant numbers are in part a reflection of how Medicaid previously covered the treatment of back pain until this year. Until recently, only muscle weakness and symptoms indicating nerve damage were widely covered. Without these symptoms, treatment was limited to primary care visits and opioids. However, in recent years, the Health Evidence Review Commission, or HERC, has found evidence that other therapies help back pain, such as yoga and massage. So based on this evidence and part of its biennial review, in 2014, the HERC created a task force to develop a way to reorganize the prioritized list to reflect the new evidence for treating back pain with these additional therapies. Then in 2015, the HERC task force completed its work and revised guidelines, resulting in coverage for additional therapies in back pain this year. With this expanded treatment, HERC also developed limitations regarding the prescribing of opioids for back pain. These limitations are evidence-based and are intended to limit the use of opioids as a first-line treatment for back pain, as well as prevent long-term use. We can see here the new back pain treatment paradigm. Now, based on what the HERC guidelines show, treatments include cognitive behavioral therapy, spinal manipulation, acupuncture, physical therapy, occupational therapy, the use of non-opioid medications, yoga, supervised exercise, and massage therapy. Additionally, there's the new limitations regarding opioid surgeries and epidural injections. So now we see just much more comprehensive approach to treating back pain than what we previously had. So in addition to these Medicaid initiatives, we also see in general across the healthcare system in Oregon, there's been a lot of activity to address opioid usage. Many regions have developed and adopted prescribing guidelines along with best practices ahead of the CDC and statewide work. Other regions have developed pain schools or persistent pain programs in coordination with CCOs to give providers, patients, and the community a resource for addressing chronic pain. When I was with the Yamhill CCO, I participated in the development of a persistent pain program. This was an 8-week program to which CCO members were referred. The program involved movement therapy, education regarding pain triggers, and consultation with the psychologist. Additionally, a peer prescriber program was developed whereby providers could refer challenging cases to a multidisciplinary team to review medical records and make recommendations regarding taper plans for weaning members off of opioids, as well as to give input to referral to other community resources for helping members manage pain. Finally, several CCOs in conjunction with local communities have begun hosting annual opioid prescribing and pain summits. Yamhill CCO just hosted its third, bringing together local medical, behavioral, and dental providers, along with CCO and OHA staff, local law enforcement, and government officials to share knowledge and develop strategies for addressing opioid prescribing and use. These efforts have resulted in provider and patient education on safe opioid prescribing. So, thank you.
Representative Kahneman, do you have a question?
Yeah, or yeah. Maybe I'll just make it a comment in light of time.
Go ahead.
But, you know, I was recently talking with some folks in the osteopathic community, physicians, and there's concern there. You know, as we look at alternative treatments, osteopaths have osteopathic manipulative treatment, which can be effective often in these, and is quite different from chiropractic treatment.
Yeah.
And historically has been fully reimbursed. It's now either denied or reimbursed at a much lower rate. I'd like some feedback. Yeah. I'm not sure now's the time, and yeah, maybe to the committee, but it seems to me we have a legitimate treatment that could be helpful.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's reflected in this slide here, the spinal manipulation. That's meant to capture both the chiropractic manipulation, or CMT, as well as osteopathic manipulative therapy, OMT. And in guideline note 56 that the HERC developed to treat low, moderate, and high-risk back pain, osteopathic manipulation is included in the guideline note as a benefit, just as chiropractic manipulation is. So it was right there with chiropractic manipulation. So
is it reimbursed at the lower rate that chiropractic treatment is paid instead of the physician rate?
Well, as far as the exact rate, I can't speak to that, but I do know it's a covered benefit.
You get back to me, please. Yes. Thank you.
So I just have a couple more very quick. And again, maybe it's just as easy to take some questions, but I wanted to be sure that there are some recognized best practices for policy. Of course, you all know about the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. There are parts of that recent changes with the House Bill 4124 actually allowed for some inclusion of the PDMP. You're now able to access it through electronic medical records, having a direct or automated notifications when patients come in would be another one. Additional potential statutory changes include things like statutes around pain clinics, which are clinics that are really devoted to prescribing pain medications potentially above standards. This is an evidence-based practice that other states have adopted. And then, of course, there's interest in drug take-back, potentially, so that when you go in for your surgery or a wound and you get your 30 pills and take 3 or 4 of them, then there's a way to not keep those drugs in the medicine cabinet. So this is my last slide. I won't go over all of it other than to say it's a complicated issue. Took us a long time to get here. There are a number of things that have to happen or be put into effect in order for us to really address the opioid epidemic. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, again, I would say thank you for this introduction. This is going to be a significant topic of our attention in the next session.
Kenny, go ahead.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. You mentioned marijuana in the beginning, and I know that there are advocates of medical use of marijuana that talk about it would be better to have people do that than get onto opioids in the first case. So I just wonder how you treated that issue.
Sure. So Chair Greenlick?
And to add a further complication, there are doctors who are refusing to treat patients with opioids when they're on marijuana as well.
So Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer. So the guidelines, really the word guideline or recommendation is what's important. These are not sort of required or regulations. But clinicians were telling us that they wanted some guidance. So the first thing is to assess. So you need to talk with the patient. Occasional use of marijuana is very different. Let's say the retail marijuana on a Friday or Saturday night is very, very different than someone who's using very, very high doses of THC. So the first thing was really assessing, looking at the use, and people were concerned about that potential high doses of marijuana might impact the ability, because it's a psychoactive substance, might impact the ability to take opioids safely and or to follow through with other. So it really is assessing, focusing on function. So there is no, the guidelines really came out sort of, here's the tool, have a discussion, understand both the use of these two and the broader picture of why people are using which medications and alternate therapies for pain. So providing that guidance, and then also really talking about consultation and documentation. So again, there's no absolute. At the same time, we do know that some clinicians are more comfortable with one than the other, and so we didn't want to say that a clinic couldn't have their standard of practice, that patients who are using high doses of medical marijuana would not get prescribed opioids. Again, that's part of the implementation that really is done at the clinic setting, at a clinical judgment, if you will. But these are guidelines.
I think we need to move on.
Okay.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you. No, we now are going to have some discussion about racial and social issues around breast replacement surgery. And would you please introduce yourself? And I'm afraid I'm going to have to continue to push on time.
Absolutely. Good morning, Chair Greenlink, Vice Chairs and members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Alan Gabriel. I'm a plastic and reconstructive surgeon at Peace Health. I have my brave breast cancer patient here, Jory Walker from Tigard, here with me. And thank you for allowing us to be here to discuss that. It's something extremely dear to both of our hearts and very, very important, and we're extremely passionate about this topic. The bottom line is what we're discussing today is we're talking about women's rights as it relates to breast cancer and bringing the value of the patient back into the perspective. And we're going to be covering very quickly, and Jory will be discussing that afterwards, what her experience has been. We all have been touched by breast cancer. You have coworkers, family members, or yourself. Oh, it's not showing up on the screen. Thank you. So when you look at the 2016 numbers, you're looking at approximately nearly 250,000 newly diagnosed cases that will be in the United States. Let's put that into perspective to this room specifically. 1 in 8 women have a lifetime risk of developing breast cancer. We have plenty of females in this audience as well as members. And so when you do the math, I mean, it's significant. There's going to be patients here that have had breast cancer or been affected by it. Unfortunately, statistics are showing that African-American women under age of 40 have the highest incidence, and this is a very common issue and most common cancer in the Latino patients. Breast reconstruction is part of making a woman whole again in the journey to become a survivor. And bringing what the patient values is extremely important in their long-term emotional and mental stability when it relates to their recovering from breast cancer and their road to survivorship. Therefore, that in 1998, the Women's Health and Cancer Rights Act that was passed as a federal mandate for insurance carriers to cover breast reconstruction, because we know that's an extremely important part of their journey. However, statistics are showing that only 1/3 of the patients are getting this information and getting reconstructed. So 70% are not being informed or have never been given the option. States such as New Jersey and others have started developing, have taken on their own agendas and wanting to educate patients through their state processes, and that's what other states have started doing, and giving the patients or our women in our community and our state the choice to have reconstruction if they choose to do so. We're still seeing it specifically with this, our population when it comes to the minorities, where only less than 40% of non-Caucasians are getting immediate reconstruction. And African-American and Latinos are less likely to undergo reconstruction. You may ask yourself, why is that? Well, maybe they're not informed of all their options. And keep in mind, breast reconstruction surgery is only part of the female feeling whole again. Maybe for a female to feel whole again is as simple as wearing a breast prosthesis and not to have reconstruction, but that's also covered as part of the federal mandate, and it's extremely important for patients to know those options. At times, patients are also not referred to breast reconstructive surgeons because of a lack of access or whatever it may be, and those are some of the things that we would like to take on and discuss. Definitely, there's some disparities that exist here, and we want to look back and bring the patient's value back into the equation and how, what is important to the patient and why are they choosing a certain treatment after all the options have been explained to them. Until all the options are not explained to the patients and they're not educated, how are they going to make an informed decision on choosing a route to treat their breast cancer and become that survivor that we all want them to be? With that, I'll thank you for your time. This was my abbreviated version. I'll pass it on to my...
Thank you, Chairman Greenlick, and the members of the committee for allowing me to discuss something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that is breast cancer. My name is Jory Walker. I'm from Tigard, Oregon, and I am a breast cancer survivor. At the time of my diagnosis, I was not informed nor educated of my treatment options. And unfortunately, breast cancer is not a one-size-fits-all. And in my particular case, the treatment options that were laid out for me were not the appropriate options for my particular case. And through a series of events, fortunately, I was able to select reconstruction, but not immediately after my diagnosis. It was a very long and painful journey, and I would love to make sure that all Oregonians, women, do not have to experience what I experienced going through it. I was privately insured. And was still not informed of my rights as a patient.
How did you get through the maze eventually?
Switching insurance companies and finding the right care providers that would explain my particular case and what my treatment options should have been given the aggressiveness of my cancer. My cancer was very aggressive. I had a lot of lymph node involvement. The tumor was much larger than they originally suspected, and many of these things they don't know until they get in there and do the surgery. Had I known what my options were, I would have taken a different path. It also added about 2 years onto my whole cancer journey. I would have been through it much quicker. I had radiation and chemotherapy. I had a lot of other treatments. I did not consider reconstruction because it was not offered to me as a patient, and my insurance company fought it.
The expectation I think we're talking about is that reconstruction surgery should be offered as a part of the original treatment plan. Is that?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yes. It's not for all women, but you need to understand what your choices are, and I was not given that choice.
I believe that every woman has the right. It's their right to know all their options. We're not saying have reconstruction, but at least you know what your options we're talking about. Based on all the information at hand, our patient or the woman can make an informed decision on what that route is going to be, because everything has its risks and benefits based on the option or the road that is chosen. And that's all we're asking, making sure they haul out the information at hand.
And I can't emphasize how important the psychological aspect of it is as well, for a lot of reasons, not just making a woman whole again, but all of the things you go through with additional testing and all of that if you don't choose to have bilateral or unilateral.
Okay, Guy, are you going to have
a... I do. I have a legislative concept that just came back yesterday, and it's basically to ask OHA and DCBS to come up with an educational campaign. I think one of the things also is that often it's better to have the reconstructive surgery if you go that route right at the same time.
Exactly.
And particularly for low-income women, it's very hard for them to take off time for their mastectomy and then take off time later again. So having the options up front to something that they're already entitled to for a law passed a long time ago at the federal level is really important. Mm-hmm. So I will have that bill. Excited
to work
with you on it.
Thank you for introducing this topic to us. We'll be addressing it, obviously, during this session. Perhaps you can join us again to help.
Yes, thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. We have a report from DCBS now, a few reports. Is that right? Mr. Allen, are you going to start us?
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Again, I'll urge you to try and be brief.
We will
all,
be. We
all
will
the be. Time you need, but not a minute more.
Got it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Barry Leslie, who's the administrator of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. And here's our PowerPoint. So we've got a couple of things to talk to you about today. One is our statutorily required update for you on the health insurance marketplace, the implementation of Senate Bill 1. We'll be brief with that, and then we'll resolve into a presentation on the basic health plan study that you have directed us to do, and which we're going to be reporting shortly to you, and essentially we'll give you a bit of a preview of what that looks like. We're in the middle of 2017 open enrollment right now on the health insurance marketplace, and it's going well. Our outreach plan focused on specific targeted populations that we thought were underserved, undercovered, and were populations that not only could we add numbers to enrollment in the marketplace, but that would add numbers that would help focus or that would help improve the overall risk profile of the individual market. And so you can see on the screen some of what those populations are. As we are into open enrollment as of December 3rd, the most recent data we have from CMS, we're at about 55,000 enrollees. We're running well ahead of where we were at this point last year. It's impossible for us to definitively say why. Each year has actually seen a year-over-year increase, and sort of my own back-of-the-napkin analysis was pretty close to this because the first year we saw about a 70% increase. Last year was about a 35% increase, so it decayed by half. I kind of assumed that we would see a similar decay before things like election results, pricing of this year's plans, and all that sort of thing factored in. So I think we're about actually on track with where we should be. The next 2 weeks' data will be really important. Those data points will include the automatic renewals by carriers, which haven't been reflected in these numbers yet, and will also reflect the first important deadline, which is December 15th for coverage effective January 1st. So we should see a significant spike from this point in those two data points. Included in open enrollment right now is the COFA program, the Compact of Free Association. This is the population of Pacific Islanders who have legal status to be in the country, but as part of the Welfare Reform Act in 1994, are excluded from participation in Medicaid. And you all created a premium support program that we administer. We priced that program out to cover a robust population because we didn't want to find ourselves being short. We priced it at about 1,500 enrollees. We think we're likely on track to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 500 enrollees total. The governor's budget includes sufficient funding going forward to be able to maintain that 300 to 500 population, and so we won't be in a position of needing to eliminate coverage for people who get it through this new program. That's been a very sort of a outreach, hand-holding, intensive kind of a process, largely done through enrollment events and we've been able to, I think, do a good job of reaching out to that population. So that really is where we sit today with the marketplace. Maybe I'll pause there for a moment and see if you've got questions about our implementation of Senate Bill 1 or where we are with the marketplace right now.
I would like to ask you, there's a great uncertainty, as you know. But when we started designing the marketplace, we started designing it for a state marketplace before we even had the federal exchange. And I'd really like you to make sure you're actively thinking about what might happen if the subsidy goes away or if the marketplace goes away, how we can improve the Oregon insurance market by having a marketplace that might include more coverage than we're talking about right now.
Absolutely, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Two comments I'll make. The day after the election, not surprisingly, we had staff who were kind of suddenly thinking about what does repeal and replace mean and what was the impact on the work that they do. And I made a very similar observation that we've been doing health insurance reform and work like this in Oregon well before there was ever an Affordable Care Act, and that we would continue to do it whether there's an Affordable Care Act or what the nature of the Affordable Care Act looks going forward. And so we are actively looking at trying to understand the emerging, well, when there is an emerging policy consensus in Washington on what repeal and replace means, we're trying to be prepared to be able to deal with that and to try to fit an Oregon approach to maximizing coverage and making sure that people have access to health care as a part of that.
That's very important. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Just a comment. I've been involved in the COFA work group, and I just wanted to thank you and your staff for an outstanding job. Seemed like a very simple task that has been profoundly complicated, but well managed, and just to say thanks.
Appreciate that. Thank you. With that, I'm going to go ahead and turn the presentation over to Ms. Leslie, who's going to talk about basic health plan.
Good morning. As Pat said, I'm Barry Leslie, and I'm the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. The first slide is just a little bit of history about the basic health plan and how we got here today, and I won't go into that because I think most of you lived it. But you do know that we were directed through House Bill 4017 to come back in December with a report on basic health plan recommendations. And so that's really just the high-level overview that I'm going to provide today, and I know you're going to be hearing from lots of other people on this topic, so I will try to be brief. The first thing to note is that the DCBS worked with a BHP subcommittee that was really worked in partnership with the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace Advisory Committee. So the subcommittee met and then would provide feedback to the advisory committee, so they'd be briefed all along on the progress and be kept up to date so that they could make what you'll hear about later, which was a final recommendation to you. So you also know that DCBS worked in partnership with Wakely Actuarial Services to really come up with the bones of what a plan would look like and then to study its impact both on Oregonians and then also on the broader insurance market. So Wakely came up with one plan that we were able to model and really use to do this kind of analysis. And that plan was a plan that included no premiums for folks beneath 138% of federal poverty level, graduated premiums for people who are above 138%, and those graduated premiums mean that people would spend about half of what they would spend if they were enrolling for a qualified health plan. There would be no cost sharing for folks under the 200% of FPL, 12 months of continuous enrollment, no adult dental, although we did price that out, and I can share that information in a little bit, and provider reimbursement of about 82% of commercial. So that's kind of what the plan looked like that they mapped out in terms of impact Oregonians. So the first couple of things we looked at, or Wakely looked at, was affordability and access. What we learned is that 52,000 people currently in 2016 would have been eligible for a basic health plan, which means that they were already below that 200% of federal poverty level. Wakely figured that with continuous enrollment, we would probably see that number increase to about 79,000 Oregonians. They also determined that the basic health plan would increase affordability for most people who'd be eligible to enroll, and they would save an average of nearly $1,100 per person. They also analyzed equity and disparities among Oregonians, and this category is pretty rich and pretty complicated. I'll just breeze through it, and you can certainly let me know if you have more questions. They looked at a number of different segments of Oregonians, the first of which are Medicaid ineligible but lawfully present immigrants. And we think there are about 5,500 of these folks in Oregon, among whom about 4,000 would qualify for some kind of tax credit. These folks would benefit because they are currently Medicaid ineligible, and they actually would qualify for a basic health plan, so they would see an improvement in terms of equity. If you're comparing the general population who is beneath 200% of federal poverty level from those who would be eligible for a basic health plan versus those who would be eligible for very generous employer-sponsored insurance, the basic health plan recipients would actually be seeing an increase in equity because they'd be on par with those folks who were in very generous employer plans. However, when you compare the basic health plan to typical plans offered to small group employers with fewer than 50 employees or even most large groups, subsidized qualified health plans are already more generous. So then you actually see that equity shift again if you compare it with most employer-sponsored plans. In terms of the family glitch, which is another category we analyzed, the BHP would not change the existing coverage and costs for a person who were caught in this particular scenario beneath that 200% of federal poverty level. We also looked at a couple different categories of Medicare folks. So, for example, Oregonians ineligible for free Part A Medicare are currently allowed to enroll in a qualified health plan, but would not be allowed to enroll in a basic health plan. And then lastly, Medicare-eligible folks who do have free Part A Medicare, they are currently excluded from a qualified health plan, and they would also remain ineligible for a basic health plan. So this wouldn't necessarily increase equity for the 138,000 or so folks who are in that category. In terms of the uninsured rate, Wakely believes that we would decrease the number of uninsured people by about 12,200 people. And in terms of the impact on market stability, the basic health plan actually creates a separate risk pool besides the individual market. And there is some belief that the BHP risk pool or the BHP category would actually kind of rob younger and healthier people from the individual risk pool. So there is that impact. And it's also believed that it would raise rates in the individual market by about 1.5%, presumably because of that fluctuation of younger and healthier people. In terms of churning and simplicity, the basic health plan does create a third set of eligibility and enrollment standards. So you'd be looking at Oregonians who would have both Medicaid eligibility and enrollment, then individual market eligibility and enrollment, and then last, a basic health plan eligibility and enrollment. So you're really looking at three different systems. And as a reminder, unless Oregon achieves some kind of integrated system for all three of those eligibility and enrollment standards, you'd need to create a third system for the basic health plan. In terms of cost projections, Wakely estimates that after the federal reimbursements for advanced premium tax credits and cost sharing, that the state's share of this program would be about $63 million. And if you add a dental to that, it'd be about $99 million. This does not take into consideration... per year, thank you very much, yes. This does not take into consideration the cost of an IT infrastructure that would need to be created or the administrative costs to develop and run that type of a program.
Can I just clarify, Doug? You're mm-hmm. saying the cost of general funds to the state would be about $100 million a year?
Chair Green, look, that's accurate if you included adult dental. If it were without dental, it would be about $63 million per year.
Per year.
And so this report was came from the advisory group that the Marketplace staff worked with and came to the Marketplace Advisory Committee. Who have made a recommendation to us that we not pursue a basic health plan. I think a key fact to know about, and I don't know many of you do, is that states that do have a basic health plan, Minnesota and New York, started out from a baseline of already devoting significant state resources to this population. And so this became a way to spend that money differently and more efficiently and gain federal match that didn't exist before. Obviously, we're not starting from that kind of a baseline, and so in this environment, the bottom line conclusion really is the benefit for the lift of looking for $60 to $100 million per year it just doesn't pencil out as the most effective way if those resources were available to try to meet the objectives here. That said, the advisory committee recommends, and we're working on pursuing in the unstable environment that Chair Greenlick observed a minute ago, other alternatives that we can pursue that do try to get at some of the same objectives of trying to reduce the cost of health care for that population that's just above, has incomes just above eligibility for Medicaid. And that'll be part of the work that we do as we look to try to understand what's going on with the federal health care and health insurance changes that are coming down the road. With that, we know you've got other people you want to hear from, but we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Just a quick one.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you remind me again how many people would be potentially eligible for this? You probably said it, and I just don't remember.
No, Chair Greenlook, Vice Chair knows about 79,000 people is what Wakely estimates would actually enroll.
But the net change, I mean, which would yield a net change in of people who have insurance who didn't have it before, presumably because cost was a barrier, of 12 to 20,000 people, which is pretty marginal.
The others would come from some other place.
Well, they would have come. They would come from the existing, individual market.
All right, so 79,000 eligible, but in terms of actual new enrollees.
12,200. Well, and actually, just to make sure we're being clear, Chair Greenlick,
from the current exchange, potentially, or
so about 12,200 of those people actually are people who formerly wouldn't have had insurance. Wakely also believes that the other 27,000 minus 12,000, 14,000. Oh no, we're doing math again. The other section of that folks would probably come from employer-sponsored insurance, because this would be more affordable than some employer-sponsored insurance, and people would be incentivized to actually make that determination and come over. So it's a net change of about 27,000 people overall, but not all. Some of those would have already had insurance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. See, we're going to hear from a couple of other folks now.
John.
That right?
Yes.
I just want to memorialize this as being your last appearance before this committee before you go off into the sunset. Is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and I expect you all to be kind to me today. So,
you're going to go on the blaze of glory, John.
Thank you. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and it would just be me today presenting on behalf of the Inclusion, Affordability, and Innovation Coalition. I want to begin by saying that we are not in disagreement with the DCBS recommendation. We recognize, after working this issue about costs, logistics, and also the reality of state and national elections, make a basic health plan troubling as far as moving forward, the path moving forward. But I do want to provide a little bit of context to this discussion, because as DCBS pointed out, we've been at this for a long time. In fact, a number of us began to talk about basic health soon after the Affordable Care Act passed, because we were concerned and created this coalition, which really has our values in the name, about inclusion and affordability and innovation. Just to talk about those briefly, the inclusion issues, of course, this committee is very well versed about the legally permanent resident population that has a five-year bar, and the COFA population, which you took steps to mitigate at least some of that with passing House Bill 4071 in the last session. And just would say that we continue to be, though, concerned about these issues for the population, and even though we recognize basic health is not the way forward, we have been engaging with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and also in the context of House Bill 4017, where the legislature really empowered DCBS to have the authority for waivers under the ACA relating to 1331 and 1332. So just as a reminder, the 1332 waiver is the waiver that is the language that Senator Wyden put into the Affordable Care Act to give states greater flexibility to design their own systems within certain parameters. The reason that we think it's still important to engage in 1332 discussions is, irrespective of what the Trump administration may do with the Affordable Care Act, we do believe there will be opportunities to explore flexibility with the federal government. And so that's why we think that it's important to have the continue to have the engage in this discussion. We don't feel that this part of the chapter is closed by any stretch of the imagination. 4017 requires DCBS to come back to you in March and talk about deliberations that they've had about 1331, but also to look at state-only options. So the last part of our name and innovation is still very important to us. As Director Pat Allen mentioned in the opening comments, that we've been at healthcare long before the Affordable Care Act. And no matter what happens with either modifying the Affordable Care Act, repeal, replacing, delay, and so forth, we fully expect as advocates that the legislature is going to be fully engaged in those issues about who's left out. The 280,000 or so people that are uninsured in the state of Oregon are still a concern. Our coalition joined up with the Mend the Gap. We really are under the Mend the Gap banner as well, and you'll hear a little bit about that later. But I want to just conclude by saying it's appropriate to say, while we're still engaged in having these kinds of discussions and advocacy work will continue, to thank once again the Department of Consumer and Business Services. They really very well engaged with us, provided information. We had good dialogue. I also want to thank the Oregon Health Authority, who previously had worked on previous iterations of the discussion about basic health. And then, frankly, I want to thank all of you. This committee has been really terrific to work with, and I also want to single out Sandy, who, as a staff person to this committee, has always been terrific to work with. And, Mr. Chair, you've been just really great to work with all the way along. And I would just say that, in a personal note, as I move off the stage, we have a very deep bench of really incredible advocates. I'm just really so impressed with the work of the Oregon Health Equity Alliance, the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, APANO, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and many others. So I know that as we pass the baton and other people come forward to provide the kind of advocacy that I know that you will listen and consider to the best of your ability about providing the next steps with helping those who are currently left out.
Thank you. You will be missed from the scene. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Allen, are you going to talk about the pharmacy benefit management thing?
No, Rick Blackwell is.
Okay, Rick, can you join us?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, Nos, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm the policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation. It's the entity within DCBS that handles both finance and insurance issues. So I'll just be brief for the benefit of the committee's time, but just give a brief overview of the budget note, how we selected the committee, how we went about exploring what was necessary for compliance under the PBM statutes, and then the next steps after submission of the report, which we delivered to the policy committees of the legislature on November 1st. So first off, the budget note basically says that we need to develop recommendations for rulemaking regarding PBM compliance. Pharmacy benefit managers, as you know, is the intermediary between the insurance companies and pharmacies for administering pharmacy benefits. So to say that they're integral to the supply chain, I think, is without question. We recognize that as well. Recommendations under the report were to lead to draft rules and statutory changes that were necessary to implement the rules. Took that to mean that we should produce maybe a minimum of statutory changes in order to implement the draft or implement the existing law. To help us with that task, we put together a group of varying perspectives from insurers, from pharmacy benefit managers, and from pharmacists themselves. We had 13 folks come together and meet with us over the summer. A little off topic, we also were working on the marijuana report, so it was a very pharmaceutical summer at DCBS. But we had five pharmacies join us, four insurance carriers domesticated within the state, and then the PBMs themselves. So our main goal, of course, was to make sure that we were achieving the goals of the budget note, which was the charter for the work group. But as an executive branch agency, we also have to figure out what does compliance actually mean when we're writing rules. And so we looked at various ways that compliance, something that we would look at as compliance in the administrative context. Were the statutes, in fact, clear enough? Would we actually have to write rules to clarify and amplify the existing provisions of the law to make sure that the underlying legislation was being fully implemented? If the legislative intent of providing certainty to the claims reimbursement process was actually being met, were rules necessary in order to make sure that we move that along incrementally? If the standards were provided enough guidance for us to work through the complaints, the allegations that we had received throughout periods before the time that we wrote the report, We looked for other states for guidance. Oregon is actually one of the first states that adopted the pharmacy benefit manager statutes, the kind of registration and enforcement type activities. Were other states able to learn from, or could we learn from other experiences that other states had had in implementing the same sorts of laws? And then finally, how could we make sure that the PBM regime integrated nicely into the existing provisions of the insurance code? I'm used to the Bank Act. The insurance code is a very sprawling work of law, and so I want to make sure that we're not adding additional complexity to that code. So we met four times this summer. We made sure that items for which we didn't think the report had enough, was scoped appropriately, or maybe things that were infeasible without further input from policymakers, were at least added to the report, but not part of our initial recommendations. So as far as next steps, we actually view the report as the first step towards more rulemaking. So in order for us to actually adopt rules, we'll still have to go through the process in the Administrative Procedures Act. That's a minimum 49 days after we've notified legislators, had public hearings. But before that, we'll probably still have advisory committees to help us go through the particulars in the recommendation to make sure that we've both balanced consumer protection appropriately and made sure that we still maintain a positive business climate for PBMs. Not going to say that's going to be an easy task, but that's what we'll have to do. So I know that's a rather brief report. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them now.
Thank you. You're busy today. I am busy today. Thank you. I had a little extra time, I guess. It's a dangerous thing. I guess, you know, I'm a little surprised as a legislator at the extent of work that occurred on the basis of a budget note. I guess, you know, I'm still in the process of coming up to speed on it, so I got some homework to do. But it seems to me that the upshot of that is essentially a rather substantial work group without legislative involvement. And I think that, as I understand it, there are some policy changes reflected in this, which I think should be legislative decisions. And I also think there are likely cost implications, cost increases. I think both of those are germane to discussion in this group, and so I just wanted to raise that. I appreciate thoroughness and good work. On the other hand, we need to be careful that we don't overreach, and that would be my criticism and concern. And earlier I gave a compliment. I guess it's time to also offer a complaint.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenemer, I know folks are watching, but I agree. I mean, in the sense that we have provided a set of recommendations for which we have not fully finished. And so certainly input from policymakers is always going to be useful and appreciated. So for that, I would obviously agree to that. So
thank you.
Yeah.
My experience has been that our problem is to get executive departments to respond to budget notes rather than well, worry about over-response. So
I guess that's part of the history that caught me off guard, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. It's caused some directors' heads, as I remember, when non-response to budget notes. Well, thank you very much. I think the report was very interesting, and I think moving forward within, as Representative Kenemer's explain some constraints, is I think a very worthwhile and important thing to do.
Chair Greenlick, and I agree, and I'd be happy to work with stakeholders further on any rules that come out of this process, or if the
policy... You should invite Representative Kennedy to join your work now.
That's what I need, more work.
I'll let you know.
Perhaps so, yes.
Oh. Just a quick question. There's the recommendation is some minor statutory changes. Is there a bill?
So, Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenegeier, it's not part of our the governor's, the approved budget or agenda that we've put forward at DCBS. So, if there is a bill, it wouldn't be derived from the agency.
It's something we need to pick up off of that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
So today, one of the LCs you're going to adopt as a committee bill provides some direction for this sort of thing.
Good. So there is something moving. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
We're going to have a little discussion on Mend the Gap now.
We should make a meeting.
Who do we have coming up?
Linda Wormald.
Pithy Way.
And I don't know that doctor. That was Xenia.
Dr. Xenia? Ms. Romaine?
What prices you can get on what's these PBMs?
Oh,
yeah.
Here's the report.
Thank you.
Good morning,
Chair
Greenlick.
Can I ask you to be brief?
Yes, we will be
brief. Cover the topic.
Yes. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Linda Roman. I'm the Director of Health Policy with the Oregon Health Equity Alliance and the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. I'm pleased to be here with my colleague, Dr. Xenia Junkier, who will join me in this presentation. Since 2009, the Oregon Health Equity Alliance has been representing the interests and concerns of communities of color, immigrants, and refugees. We are a member organization of over 40 organizations. That includes the Urban League of Portland, the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, APANO, UNITE, and the Native American Youth Center as well. OHE has been consistently engaged in state-level policy because of two intersected beliefs. The first is that we believe that we all pay the price for poor health. Study after study, including the Mend the Gap report, underscore the high cost of the health system, and this undermines our economy, the financial and emotional toll on families and small businesses when Oregonians do not have the care that they need. Secondly, access to care is the cornerstone of well-being for working families, and affordable insurance is critical to the future prosperity of all 36 counties in Oregon. In Oregon, we've made some great strides. Many Oregonians are still left behind. What we're sharing today is an update on the Mend the Gap report on the profile of the remaining uninsured. So today in Oregon, our innovative reforms have reduced our state's uninsured to approximately 280,000 Oregonians. OHE applauds the improvements and recognizes the stability and good health that this has realized for so many Oregonians. We want to thank this committee for your work in reducing Oregon's uninsured. We particularly celebrate the outreach and enrollment happening today as we speak.
Could I ask you to try and speak up a little?
Yes. For the uninsured, for the COFA, Compact of Free Association, Premium Assistance Program. So we're very excited that that outreach and education is happening as we speak. In addition, the investments over the last year to ensure that we study affordable options and coverage. So we thank you all for your work in doing that. The remaining uninsured, they live in every city and county of our state. They are primarily low-wage workers, working adults and families who face exclusions due to their residency, but also some of them qualify for Medicaid, but also turn onto the marketplace and struggle to afford premiums as well. The 280,000 uninsured also includes 10,000 legal permanent residents who reside in the United States and have a five-year bar for the first 5 years of the residency. They have a ban on the Oregon Health Plan. It also includes 1,500 COFA Pacific Islanders who face a lifetime ban. OHE continues to prioritize these communities because we believe that Oregon values the health of all her citizens and has the capacity to be continue to be a national leader to ensure everyone has coverage. In addition, 2% of Oregon children do not have coverage. That is 17,600 children who live, play, and learn in every county of our state. We celebrate that 98% of children in our state have coverage, and we must continue to ensure that all children have the same access to dignified and quality health care as their classmates. We already know that coverage works for kids. For example, children on Medicaid have more than a 50% decline in asthma treatments in the ER. This saves our hospitals and our health systems millions if we can prevent expensive visits to the ER. And we know that healthy children are more likely to do well in school, giving them a better opportunity to thrive as adults. For children on Medicaid, we saw a 26% decline in high blood pressure as adults and fewer ER visits and hospitalizations as adults as well. An investment in CoverAll Kids means that we're able to set our children up for success in their lives as they grow up. And we applaud Governor Kate Brown for moving forward a budget that ensures that all children get the care that they need. Moving forward, we want to prevent needless suffering and economic hardship and even death for the remaining uninsured children. We look forward to working with this committee on Cover All Kids. Now, I'd like to hand it to Dr. Junkier to talk about the populations, additional populations that is identified in the Mend the Gap report.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair, Member of the Committee, my name is Dr. Xenia Junkier. I'm the Director of Equity and Community Engagement for the Oregon Foundation for Reproductive Health. We've been a proud member of the OHEI Coalition for the past 4 years. Gaps in reproductive health care disproportionately affect women of color, low-income women, and over 100,000 Oregonians still lack access to meaningful coverage for the full range of reproductive health care. Given the recent shift in Congress, reproductive health coverage and access are further threatened. Now is the time to be proactive. What does the Oregon we want to see look like? Who are we still leaving behind? There are still remaining gaps in access to reproductive health coverage that need to be filled. The Affordable Care Act currently secures coverage for preventive reproductive health services at no cost to the consumer. The Oregon Legislature adopted the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion, and with that provided 360,000 women with fully covered reproductive health services. We commend all of you for the work that you have done to provide these additional and more affordable, accessible health care services. Currently, as it stands, 18,000 women still lack meaningful reproductive health care coverage due to loopholes in the Affordable Care Act. As we face the repeal, the coverage of these 360,000 women I mentioned earlier is on the line. Our goal is to codify in Oregon statute the Affordable Care Act provisions related to preventive reproductive health access, closing existing loopholes in federally required coverage, and ensuring that access to reproductive health care is meaningful. It establishes reproductive health coverage for all people, including men. All services required to be covered without cost sharing for women are also covered for men, including testing for sexually transmitted infections and coverage for sterilization. Vasectomy is one of the most effective and most desirable forms of contraception for both men and women, making it a critical service that all Oregonians should be able to access. We also know that an estimated 43,000 women of reproductive age in Oregon who purchase insurance on the exchange, as well as an unknown number of women with employer-sponsored coverage, have policies with deductibles of $2,500 or more. While most plans cover abortion, the cost of the procedure must first come out of this deductible, leaving the procedure unaffordable and inaccessible to many. By including abortion into the list of services that must be covered at zero out-of-pocket cost, this bill further continues Oregon's long-standing tradition of treating abortion as part of the full spectrum of reproductive health care. One of the first priorities for the Oregon Health Equity Alliance was access to prenatal care for all women. Our communities are stronger when all babies get the best start in life. Although we have been able to leverage this significant policy, coverage drops immediately after labor and delivery. This means we are leaving mothers without vital care that is needed after delivering a baby. We know postpartum care is critical for the health and safety of both mothers and children, which is why it's imperative that we ensure the postpartum care for all Oregonians. Furthermore, there are 40,000 women in Oregon who are categorically excluded from health coverage based on their citizenship status. For this population, this bill expands access to family planning and establishes coverage for abortion. And finally, transgender and gender nonconforming Oregonians need access to services often categorized as women's health services, including gender-specific cancer screenings and the full range of reproductive health services. Unfortunately, when coverage is dependent on one's gender marker, procedural barriers can hinder access to this necessary and life-saving care. We want to be able to prohibit discrimination based on gender and gender identity in reproductive health care. Thank you.
So we do recognize that this is a difficult time in our state, and we understand that the budget shortfalls significantly threaten the care of thousands of Oregonians rely on. But we must be determined to roll up our sleeves and create the Oregon that is equitable and inclusive of all in our state. This includes extending coverage to over 17,600 children in our state who have gone without coverage for decades. This also includes the hundreds of thousands thousands of women who lack access to affordable and comprehensive reproductive health care coverage. And what remains to be true is that these circumstances cannot allow us to go backwards. The gaps in health care cannot widen, and this is simply unacceptable. So Oregonians are counting on us to find a solution, and OHE looks forward to working in coalition with many partners in this room and you all in this committee to help ensure that health care coverage for all Oregonians. Thank you. We're happy to take any questions if there's time.
It's going to be a bumpy ride this session, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Thank you very much for your
Thank
report.
You. Thank you.
All right. We're going to hear about patient-centered primary care homes. Get Dr. Rickard back. Talk about this.
Morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Nose.
Flying solo on this one.
Flying solo, yes. Thank you. I was asked to present this report recently released by Portland State University entitled Implementation of Oregon's PCPCH Program, Exemplary Practice and Program Findings, released September of 2016. I'd like to acknowledge this report was prepared by Portland State University staff, Cheryl Gelman, Neil Wallace, Billy Sandberg, Shauna Petchel, Nicole Baranis, and it was commissioned by the OHA. First, a bit of background on the PCPCH program. The Oregon legislature established the patient-centered primary care home program in 2009 to create access to patient-centered, high-quality care and to reduce costs by supporting practice transformation. PCPCH is Oregon's version of a medical home. The program is administered by the Oregon Health Authority and housed in its transformation center. When developed, the program was tasked with four main items. One, develop strategies to identify and qualify clinics for the program. Two, utilize the same strategies to measure the quality of clinics. Three, promote the development of PCPCH clinics. And finally, encourage individuals who are covered by the Oregon Health Plan to receive care in the model. I will note that it's not just Oregon Health Plan members that receive care in PCPCHs. It really is all Oregonians. Primary care clinics voluntarily apply for recognition by the program, and based on the various standards of the program they are able to meet, are recognized as a medical home with a designated tier level. Oregon currently has 647 recognized PCPCHs, representing over two-thirds of all primary care clinics in the state. The program is defined by six core attributes. These include access to care, accountability, comprehensive whole person care, accountability, coordination and integration, as well as person and family-centered care. The recent PSU report evaluates the experience of the clinics enrolled in the program from October 2011 to September of 2014. The report looks at both qualitative and quantitative data. For the qualitative portion of the report, interviews of clinic staff from 20 high-functioning exemplary clinics that had implemented the advanced model measures were conducted. For the quantitative portion, an analysis of expenditures and utilization of services performed in the clinics that were designated as PCPCH to non-PCPCH clinics was conducted using the All Payers, All Claims database. The report had three main aims. One, to understand the organizational conditions and process improvement activities of exemplary clinics. Two, to estimate the impact of the program on the utilization and expenditure patterns of clinics' clientele. And then finally, to assess the consistency and usefulness of PCPCH scoring and evaluating PCPCH performance. Regarding the results of AIM 1, understanding the organizational conditions and process improvement activities of exemplary clinics, a number of understandings were found to help clinics not only implement the program successfully, but also embrace it as the right way to provide care. These understandings include an ability to harness the power of teams to facilitate patient care, so they enacted team-based care models, standardization of policy and practices, integration of the role of a care coordinator, and an organizational culture that embraces a willingness to experiment, adapt, and learn. Next, I'll skip to AIM 3 before ending with the financial impacts of AIM 2. Again, the intent of AIM 3 in the study was to assess the consistency and usefulness of PCPCH scoring and evaluating performance. The report found the six core attributes work best in concert. The cumulative effect of the attributes has more impact on cost and utilization measures than their independent effects. Overall, these results suggest that the program's current approach to awarding tier recognition on the basis of total points rather than minimum points within each category is an effective strategy. Finally, on to aim two of the study, which is intended to estimate the impact of the PCPH program on the utilization and expenditure patterns of clinics clientele. Several key financial outcomes are noted. For every $1 increase in primary care expenditures related to the PCPCH program, there's a $13 savings in other services such as specialty care, emergency department care, and inpatient care. So a 13-to-1 return on investment for every dollar invested in primary care. The program, since it's been implemented between 2012 and 2014, has generated over $240 million in savings for the Oregon healthcare system. And finally, for each clinic that's been a PCPCH for 3 years, the total cost of care per member per month is lowered by $28. This is double the overall savings of $14 per member per month for a clinic in the first year of recognition. So in other words, the longer a clinic is recognized as PCPCH, the more savings it generates. The reasons, again, for these cost savings is largely the result of significantly lower utilization of costly specialty visits and emergency department visits. While the report points to the success of the program, overall the study revealed some considerations that can be addressed. These considerations are essential to advance the program's goals and future success. First, payment models and other financial arrangements do not currently incentivize clinics to operate in alignment with the PCPCH program aims. Clinic leaders struggle to financially support the changes necessary for both general and top-tier recognition. This is largely the result of our predominant fee-for-service payment model. Barriers to information exchange with other clinics and hospitals significantly impede PCPCH clinics. The lack of interoperability across EHR platforms can rarely be addressed by individual clinics. And then finally, clinics most affected by Medicaid expansion find that newly insured patients need time to learn to navigate the primary care system. These clinics need robust networks of social services as they serve patients whose housing, transportation, and economic situations complicate medical care. For the program to be sustained and spread further, the report notes there's a need to address barriers to the program's implementation and sustainability, to assess both exemplary clinics to sustain a learning organization model, and those clinics that are either struggling with or thinking about PCPCH clinic implementation to be supported. Clinics must be aware that PCPCH implementation is a long and ongoing process, and while there's a potential for a return on investment in the long run, it requires considerable investment of resources in the beginning. So, thank you. Questions?
Any questions? Did the report look at the difference between those that had capitation payments, a higher proportion of capitation payments and fee-for-service payments?
No, it didn't take that into account. It was just
they
expenditures.
Didn't talk about the fee-for-service dominated the field.
Well, it noted that the current climate of reimbursement, which is dominantly fee-for-service, is a challenge, yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yep, thank you.
I need to thank the PSU crew. They sound like they did a really good job.
Yeah, I will. Thanks.
Okay. Let's move on. Where are we now? Well, we're going to talk about disaster planning. A little bit. We have a panel. Join us. I'm glad that...
Mark.
No, go ahead.
Mike Harriman, Commissioner Thompson, and Jay Wilson is the first panel. Thank you.
Okay. We have two panels.
Yes, sir.
Nice to see you.
Chair Greenlick, for the record, I'm Mike Harriman. I'm the State Resilience Officer. And as I spoke with you back in October, you asked that I would come and bring some data and information on mass care and mass displacement that will be a result of the Cascadia subduction zone unzipping and the follow-on tsunamis that the Oregon coastline and the state of Oregon and the Pacific Northwest will see. In 2013, the Oregon Resiliency Plan was introduced to the 77th Legislature, and it focused primarily on our critical infrastructure, transportation routes, ports, electricity, natural gas, fuel, water systems, communication, the things that connect the state. What it didn't address was the people.
And so nothing about public health at all.
But. Not at all. A little bit about the public water systems, but that's about it. So today I'm going to introduce some groups that we have started to have a discussion to do some building blocks. The Oregon Association of Counties, the Oregon State Seismic Policy Advisory Commission, the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Food Bank, and the American Red Cross. Not here today, who was willing to come, was also the Oregon chapter of the Alzheimer's Association and the Oregon chapter of the Blind for Seeing and Sight Impairment of Oregon. So with that, I'll turn it over to Commissioner Thompson.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm glad to be here today. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Leanne Thompson. I'm heavily involved in preparing Oregon's coastal communities for a disaster or many disasters. I'm an emergency community response team CERT member. I'm a Medical Reserve Corps member. I'm licensed in ham radio. I'm actually here today both as a Clatsop County Commissioner and as co-chair of the Association of Oregon County's Public Safety Subcommittee on Resilience, newly formed. We had our first meeting yesterday. We had 23 people attending, which is heartening, I'd say. We're already working to improve the resilience of Oregon's counties and communities. In the event of a 9.0 magnitude earthquake along the Cascadia subduction zone and the resulting tsunami, survival and recovery will depend heavily upon how well nonprofits, businesses, and governments at all levels integrate and coordinate the responses. It's heartening today to listen to the systems integration theory repeated again and again. We're here to do that. The Cascadia Rising exercise last June was designed to simulate this event and stress test our emergency management systems. In that, it was successful. When we're looking for information, a no is as good as a yes. There were a variety of challenges that were both expected and not, and learning from these experiences is part of the important work ahead of us. The coordinated direction Mike Harriman is taking to learn from the Cascadia Rising exercise, as well as to identify other resilience best practices, is encouraging. This integration and cooperation will continue to improve as more partners come together to address our joint concerns and issues. One of the items we have identified is a need for human services, medical care, and shelter for thousands of displaced people in the event of the Cascadia earthquake. If the earthquake were to happen over the 4th of July weekend, Seaside would see an estimated 100,000 more people without a place to go. The regular population of Clatsop County hovers around 38,000. The 4th of July population, 100,000 extra folks in our system on an average, and that's only in Seaside, on an average holiday weekend, 40,000 extra people coming. It's big, and that's just one town. On the other hand, we want you to keep on coming, so there will not be any routes back over the coast.
We're going to plan on outlawing an earthquake.
Sir, if that works, I would be delighted to conclude. Much of our existing housing will have been jeopardized by the earthquake, if not demolished by the tsunami. This means that in my community, there will be thousands of people with nowhere to stay and nowhere to receive care for weeks, at least. There are a variety of opportunities to enhance our preparedness and mitigate the consequences in these circumstances. The one I wanted to focus on today is to develop sustainable emergency housing near the coastal areas. I've been working in my county to build capacity for sustainable and modular housing that will improve resilience. The governor's wood products working group, I'd refer to that just in passing. Chair Greenlick, I look forward to working with you and the other members of this committee to improve resilience throughout Oregon. Please keep me and the AOC Resilience Subcommittee in mind as you are considering how best to improve the preparedness, survival, and recovery of Oregon's counties. We want to flourish. We don't want to just survive. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jay Wilson. I'm a community disaster manager in Clackamas County, Oregon, but today I represent the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission as the chair. We are the authors of the 2013 Oregon Resilience Plan, and as Mike Harriman said, we focused, as we were directed, on infrastructure, and we said in our next steps that we were going to focus on community resilience, and we began in 2015. We're happy to be here this morning to talk about one of the biggest aspects of community resilience is around people, their lives and their livelihoods, and how so many of the issues we're talking about today in this room are all going to be affected when this event does occur, and why we need to begin planning now for a better understanding of the complexity of all of these systems and their relationships, but also not waiting to deal with this in a reactive mode after things are broken, that people can't wait for that to happen then, and that resilience really comes from applying the benefits and the capacity in our day-to-day decision-making. It's not only just an emergency lens that we're looking at. It's really what we do every day. I think one of the things we haven't really stated when we talk about this disaster and the loss of all the systems we depend on is that this is going to quickly escalate into a humanitarian crisis in Oregon, especially on the coast, but going inland to I-5 too, without water, wastewater, and the medical systems we depend on. People are going to be isolated. When they're displaced, they lose their connectivity with their families and their communities. And unless we start investing a holistic approach now and coming back at the 2019 legislature with strategies, with priorities, I worry that when this occurs, we're going to be dependent on our federal authorities to come in and apply more cookie-cutter approaches to Oregon's unique needs. And we really can't afford that. And so our urge from OSPAC especially is that community connectedness is critical. The health and welfare of our communities is in jeopardy when this occurs, and that day-to-day decisions we're making right now can either build capacity or increase our vulnerability. And so we need a concerted effort to look at this going forward. And we're hopeful that the approaches we're talking about right now can become long-term investments for everyone's welfare. Thank you.
Well, one of our key topics is going to be the modernization of the public health system. It's going to be particularly relevant, I think, in the coastal community.
Exactly.
Yes, okay. We have three more folks coming up, so we'll stick around for questions.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
In your Cascadia Rising exercise, what was your experience with regards to the redundancy of the electric grid in Central Oregon, which will be the primary recovery grounds for the state?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, I don't believe that was attested in part of the exercise. Yeah. The exercise was a four-day exercise for the first 4 days. I did not see, and I worked in the State Emergency Coordination Center with all 27 state agencies. We did not get to look past the coastal communities. We struggled with providing just some basic life support in those first 4 days, let alone the impact of the electrical grid in the state of Oregon.
Yeah, I would encourage you to really look into that. I have great concerns of the capacity of Central Oregon to recover or to be the center of recovery for the rest of the state, especially if it's wintertime, if there's not a functioning electrical grid into Central Oregon. I would love to have some feedback on that capability.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair, members of the Commission. Representative Bueller, I worked radios in Cannon Beach during that. We saw problems all over. And one of the things that the Association of Oregon County Subcommittee on Resilience can do is address that very issue. So thank you for raising it. We'll look into it.
And the second issue is the capacity of Highway 97, if it becomes the primary north-south route to recovery of the state. Frequently between Lapine and Madras, as is, it's at capacity. So to put the rest of the state's north-south traffic on that highway is concerning also.
Hey, can we have the next panel, please?
They seem to be coming in and out.
Please good morning, introduce Chair yourself Greenwich, as you go.
Vice chairs, members of the committee, and a hello to Representative Bueller as a primary resident of Bend. You and I both know the Sandham Pass rather
well. Yes. Will you introduce yourself?
My name is Stan Thomas. I'm the emergency manager and business continuity program manager for the Department of Human Services. My role in this process is the primary contact for what we call Emergency Support Function 6 and Emergency Support Function 11 under the state's Emergency Operations Plan. That's mass care and food and water. And it comprises of a large group of organizations and people. I have with me today Kara Sloman with the Red Cross and Annalise Kohler with the Oregon Food Bank, who are part of that team. I'd like to start off real quickly by giving you a little bit of background of what we do for mass care and mass displacement. And when we say mass care, mass displacement, we're talking about survivors of a catastrophic event. So basically, if you do not need advanced medical care, if you're looking for shelter, emergency relief supplies, emergency housing, those types of necessities after a disaster, that's where mass care kicks in. The current status of where we're at, and a lot of lessons learned from the Cascadia subduction zone, is the Department of Human Services is the lead agency in mass care services under the Oregon Emergency Management Plan. Redirected focus, worked on strengthening relationships with organizations that we already had partnerships, such as the Red Cross and the Oregon Food Bank, and reaching out to other organizations such as the Salvation Army and other agencies such as the Employment Division, Veterans Affairs, Education, to try to get a group together to really focus on these strategies of how we deal with the concern of mass displacement of people in a catastrophic event. One of the things that we looked at early on was trying to develop an organizational structure, and we moved to a task force structure. And the task forces that we've developed at this point, and when I say developed, I'm talking about setting up the organizational structure. We don't have a lot of bandwidth through all these organizations to fill those task forces yet, but this is kind of the framework in which we hope to work under. A sheltering task force, a feeding task force, disaster housing task force, emergency needs, and I call that the teddy bears and toilet paper, all those things that people need that we don't often think about. Children and Family Services Task Force, Behavioral Health, and a Social Services Task Force, and also an Access and Functional Needs Task Force, because there's a large population that can be underserved in a disaster that we really need to stay focused on and is critical. Like I had mentioned, although these task forces have been identified, we don't have a lot of them coming together. We do hope to work closely with the Oregon Food Bank in 2017 to develop an Oregon disaster feeding plan that we can get a group together, develop that plan, and then hopefully test it in the later part of 2017. One of the things we learned from the Cascadia Rising exercise is in a Cascadia subduction zone type event, we were faced with about 1.15 or 1.5 million people that needed some type of emergency relief. That spreads across the state. It's easy to look at the coast, and the coast will have the largest impact, but what's critical to understand is damage is expected all the way into the I-5 corridor. And as far as Central Oregon goes, that's going to be our primary channels for relief coming into Oregon. And there will be a lot of relief coming in, but the organization and how we move that relief is going to be extremely important. One of the things that we look at that becomes critical is how do we manage the displacement? Mr. Wilson indicated the movement of people, but also the isolation and how we coordinate that. One of the things that we're currently working on with several of our partner agencies, such as Oregon Emergency Management, who kind of leads the charge, Oregon Health Authority, Oregon Department of Energy, Department of Human Services, is how we can logistically move supplies into that area. So those are some of the things that we're working on, and I want to turn it over to my colleagues with the Red Cross and the Oregon Food Bank to talk about their activities and how they work with us. Thank you.
Chair Greenleg, members of the committee. My name is Kara Sloman. I'm the Regional Disaster Officer for the American Red Cross in Oregon. Your local Red Cross responds to about two disasters each and every day, mostly house fires, making sure that families have immediate resources for food, clothing, shelter, and health-related needs. But we also respond annually to larger disasters such as wildfires, floods, winter storms, certainly keeping an eye on all the weather we've been having lately, and our response activity picks up accordingly. We work with communities year-round to help prepare for these types of disasters, as well as the larger disasters such as the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake that we're talking about today. We know that this kind of an event will require an unprecedented response with an immediate need for life-sustaining mass care and mass displacement services that will truly require a whole community response. The Red Cross is a key support agency for Emergency Support Function 6 and works with our government and community partners to support mass care planning efforts. As a member of the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, the Red Cross also participated in the development of the Oregon Resilience Plan. And as you heard from other folks today, beyond infrastructure, we've also got to focus on the resiliency work to address human needs. We felt that was the most significant gap in the Oregon Resilience Plan. The Cascadia Rising exercise last summer, we actively participated in at a local, state, and national level. And we certainly took away lessons learned that we're working on incorporating into our planning efforts. We know that following a Cascadia subduction zone event, mass care services and sheltering aren't about cots and blankets, but rather about keeping people safe from the elements. It really becomes a life-sustaining service after this type of an event. The immediate need for sanitation, water, and food supplies will require specialized logistics teams from both the state and federal governments and other relief agencies to keep survivors alive and healthy. We're committed to working with the Oregon Department of Human Services as well as the Oregon Office of Emergency Management to identify strategies for building readiness and coordinating response and recovery activities to reduce the human impacts following the Cascadia subduction zone event. As part of our public education efforts this past year, we've undertaken a new education program called Prepare Out Loud. Since last spring, we've had about 5,000 participants come to our Prepare Out Loud presentations across the state. And I really personally refer to it as the closest thing you can attend to a motivational preparedness talk. So we have a great presentation that really focuses on the Cascadia subduction zone, education about what it is, how to be prepared, and most importantly at the end, asking, really truly making it ask of folks to commit to being prepared. And we say prepare out loud because we want folks sharing their preparedness. We don't want them to do it quietly and keep it a secret. We want them to tell their friends, family, and their social networks actions that they're taking to get ready for a Cascadia subduction zone event. We believe activities like that will help increase the likelihood of others hearing it from their friends and family and taking their own preparedness actions as well. So the Red Cross, we truly appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today, and I thank you for your time. I'll turn it over to Annalise.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Annalisa Curler, and I work for Oregon Food Bank. In addition to providing emergency food to Oregonians experiencing hunger throughout our state, we also work on disaster response and preparedness. We have a dedicated staff person who works to ensure that Oregonians facing disaster have access to the food that they need. We do this at kind of small scale level, so think a flood or a fire, 5 to 10 families that are maybe affected, all the way up to working with the folks right here to plan for a larger scale earthquake, the Cascadia subduction zone. In addition, we are also working really hard at preparing ourselves for a large-scale disaster. Currently, as we speak, at our Portland facility, we are installing a large-scale generator and fuel storage, the hope being that in the loss of power, we are still able to use our facilities and get our trucks on the roads. We are working with our coastal partners to store food within those communities, knowing that even if we can get those trucks on the roads, they probably won't be able to get to the coast. The coast is particularly vulnerable, as I'm sure you are aware. And so wanting to make sure that we have food already in those places is very important. We are also partnering with OEM and the Oregon Amateur Radio Emergency Services on enhanced ham radio communications. We currently have the capability to use ham radio from Ontario all the way to Tillamook and then up and down the I-5 corridor. And this is all working with our regional food bank partners to do this work. Overall, like Carrie said, we are definitely excited to be at the table and looking forward to continuing to work with our partners to make sure that Oregonians in disaster have access to food.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
I have a question. Do you have any general number of what you think it would take, physical infrastructure and then the human infrastructure, to adequately prepare for this? Is there some big number in your head?
Wow. I don't have a number to really put out there as far as what it would take. The biggest thing that it takes is a coordinated effort at all levels of government, that communication up and down. It's going to be expensive.
It would take more money than we print.
Yeah, that's right.
But I'm sorry, I don't have a specific number to give you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Keep working on it, and we'll be talking about public health issues during this session. I'm going to close the informational hearing and move the agenda just a little bit to open a work session for the purpose of introducing committee bills. I want to remind the committee that by introducing a bill as a committee bill, we take no position on it. It doesn't mean we recommend it or we don't recommend it. It just means it puts the bill into the process under the committee title. And I will ask Representative Nose for a motion.
Mr. Chair, we have 13 committee LCs to be introduced as committee bills. They are as follows. LC 1267, dated November 3rd, 2016. LC 1285, dated 12-7-16. LC 1299, dated 10-17-16. LC 1372, dated September 23rd, 2016. LC 1373, dated September 21st, 2016. LC 1597, dated October 7th, 2016. LC 1835, dated December 5th, 2016. LC 1891, dated September 28th, 2016. LC 2406, dated November 2nd, 2016. LC 2407, dated December 6, 2016. LC 2410, dated December 4th, 2016. LC 2450, dated November 8th, 2016. And finally, last but not least, LC 3109, dated December 2nd, 2016.
Representative Nose moves the listed bills be introduced as committee bill. Any discussion? Representative Kennemer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, at least historically, these often are done as a courtesy, and I think that's appropriate, and I'm okay with that. I would like to make a couple of comments, and it's unfortunate in my mind that we haven't had the next agenda discussion about antibiotics and bacteria, because that would be interesting, because LC 2410 is related to that issue. However, I guess in my 18 years of experience in the legislature, I think these kinds of bills generally go to ag and natural resources. And so I just wanted to note that. I guess we can change tradition, but it's an interesting issue. The second one is...
I've tried to get bills snuck to a committee by having it introduced. It doesn't work. It'll go where it's going to go.
Well, I would assume that the speaker and her staff will be working diligently to make good decisions, but also know politics plays sometimes.
Yes, they do.
Secondly, Representatives Nose and Lively and I were on the High Cost of Pharmaceuticals work group, and that bill is included here. I have some serious concerns within that, but I think it's an important discussion we've got to have, and we have to move forward with something. I may or may not be in agreement with the ultimate amendments, but I think it was a good work group, and I would commend Rob for his leadership and Representative Lively for his participation. And I think we had great participation from a broad array of folks. Unfortunately, it's a difficult issue on which to find consensus, And frankly, I thought the chair was good in saying, well, sometimes you just have to land on one side. And he sort of did, in my perspective. You choose your landings.
The work isn't over on that one. I'm sure we have a...
It's not.
Yeah, I think it'll last. We may have some debate on that topic.
It's possible. And we may have a few amendments.
And a few amendments. Thank you.
Senator Buehler?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlick. I just want to explain that I'll be voting no on all the committee bills, primarily because of a principal reason. I think there should be more accountability in this process, and I'd like to see members attached to the bills and not just a committee.
I've told members they can try and get their fingerprints off a bill by making it a committee bill, but if they want to pass it, they're going to have to come out in the open. So I think we'll know on any of these that actually go forward. I think that's an important point. I think accountability is important. I think we've moved that forward by making sure we know who asks for amendments nowadays, and I think that's an accountability thing that I think is useful. The principle is an important one. Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
No.
Representative Klein?
Excuse.
Representative Kenmer?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Noss?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Excuse.
And Chair Green?
Aye. Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Kenmer. We'll close the work session and move back onto the agenda. Let's see if we can find where we are.
Just a whole last page.
We are on the discussion that Representative Kenmer asked us to have. Can I invite who we have?
Don Nolte.
John Neumeister and
Don Nolte.
And
my son was
fired. We will.
And then that's it.
Then the next panel will be.
It's just one gentleman.
Rich Carnaville from the Farm Bureau, I think.
Good morning, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Dawn Nolte. I'm a physician at Oregon Health and Science University and Dornbecker Children's Hospital. I have a PowerPoint presentation, so I was hoping that could come up.
Okay. Will you, the microphone a little bit
closer?
Just turn it here. No,
a little more direct on, so we can hear you better.
Thank you.
That's okay.
All right. So thank you for the opportunity to speak on antibiotic-resistant bacteria. These are my credentials. It's not working.
Well, I don't know.
It's better than before.
Pardon me.
Certainly.
Just holler at us.
I'm very good at that. So these are my credentials. I'm a pediatric infectious disease doctor with training and my current role at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. So I wanted to speak about antibiotic-resistant bacteria, the costs that this would entail, and the medical consensus in my field on the use of antibiotics and how to prevent resistant bacteria. So bacteria are single-celled organisms. They cause infection. We also know that they're part of our microbiome. And antibiotics are medications that are used in my field to treat or prevent specific infections, and it decreases this by decreasing number of bacteria at infected sites. So resistant bacteria are known as those that are unable to be treated by the usual first line of antibiotics. Now, resistance can occur in bacteria just sort of spontaneously, and then the bacteria then get a survival advantage. But this genetic change can also be forced or accelerated through the presence of antibiotics. So I have a little animation here. So antibiotic resistance happens when you have a whole group of bacteria, and in blue are the normal bacteria. Every so often there's a little troublemaker, a little resistant bacteria. You then bathe this bacteria colony because of an infection, bathe them with lots of antibiotics, and the usual bacteria die, but the little troublemaker stays around. And then that one proliferates, and then after a while you get the antibiotics, the resistant bacteria. So this is pretty easily seen in a very common infection, such as ear infections in kids, and I'm a pediatrician, so this is what I look at. So about 15 years ago, we could treat ear infections with 1 teaspoon of a medication called amoxicillin, and we do it for 10 days. And so now we have to give a stronger cousin, so amoxiclav or Augmentin, you may have heard. We give 2 teaspoons for 14 days, and this is just to try to overwhelm the resistant bacteria that live in the middle ear of children. So this is a cartoon showing that resistant antibiotics aren't just in hospital. They're not just in very weak or fragile people. They can certainly start in the hospital, and then they move out into communities, into other hospitals. Over to the left, they'll move out into long care facilities, into the community. And over to the right, certainly they can start off in factory farms and move up into people. And that little plane up there in the upper right corner shows that antibiotic-resistant bacteria just a flight away. So this is such a big problem. The Centers for Disease Control, or the CDC, put out a big report in 2013 talking about antibiotic-resistant bacteria and the toll that this takes. And it concluded, which is a severe underrepresentation, that about 2 million deaths, 2 million illnesses are attributed to antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and about 23,000 deaths in the United States, or 63 deaths an hour. So this is just in the United States. Something that received a great bit of attention was a report that came out from the UK. It was commissioned by the Prime Minister at that time. It was called Antimicrobial Resistance. And it projected, using math modeling, what would happen in the next 50 years. So in the United States, we already talked about 23,000 deaths in this era. And it's projected in 50 years that it would be 10 times that. Europe has a similar sort of escalation in current statistics. Its current estimates, 27,000 deaths now and close to 400,000 in about 50 years. And the death toll worldwide currently is 700,000 deaths a year. That will be 10 million in 50 years. So what can we do about antibiotic-resistant bacteria? We can try to make more, except there's not a lot of impetus for pharmaceutical companies to make new antibiotics. And so we have to look at another venue, and that would be to try to use antibiotics wisely. The thought is that if you overuse antibiotics, you cause resistance. So hopefully the reverse is that you use antibiotics less and you prevent the emergence of these resistant bacteria. So in my field, we use antibiotics for infection, for the fear of infection. And so we treat them. We have a suspected or proven infection, and we are very specific about the bacteria we're treating, the site we're treating, and what patient we're treating this in. We can certainly use antibiotics as prophylaxis in the prevention of treatment. Those two instances would be to prevent an outbreak. You have someone who has a very contagious disease, such as meningococcemia. You don't want it spread to the college campuses. The other way you would prevent infections, and you would use antibiotics for that, would be in certain patient populations in which you know there's a high risk of infection. So cancer patients, patients who undergo invasive surgery, those would be very few limitations on use of prophylaxis. And so I talked about that. And so take-home points is antibiotic-resistant bacteria, the costs, and certainly the deaths that are going to incur in the next 50 years, and that we are going to enter what's called a post-antibiotic era. And the medical consensus on the use of antibiotics in my field as a pediatric infectious disease doctor is we use antibiotics to treat or prevent infection. Thank you.
Hello, I'm John Neumeister. I was asked to provide a perspective from agriculture today, and I hope to tell you not only what's possible, but what can be done with my story. So I grew up on a farm in southern Ohio, raised cattle and sheep with my father, and moved out here in 1973, and since then basically farmed, worked outside jobs to farmed or worked in agriculture. I, along the way, picked up a bachelor's in science, animal science, and a master's in crop science from Oregon State University. And I've worked in conventional agriculture several years as a research agronomist on conventional pesticide research, and also 9 years with Pennington Seed Company in the valley here, and based in Lebanon as a field contractor. However, in 1984, when I was able to purchase my own farm, I wanted to get back to raising sheep and was determined to do it in as natural a way as possible. We named our place Cattail Creek Farm. About a year later, we were approached by one of the first farm-to-table restaurants, the Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California, that had heard about us, came out, loved what we were doing, tasted the lamb, loved that, became a customer, and are still to this day, 32 years later. Light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, why can't I sell direct in Oregon? So we started out in Eugene, the old Oregon homegrown meat and the Xenon Cafe and a few Locker Lamb customers, and that's where we were at for a few years. But demand from our customers and potential customers quickly outstripped the ability of my small farm to produce, and we recruited some larger ranchers that were in agreement with our values and willing to grow the protocol I developed, which was 100% grass-fed from through finishing, no routine antibiotics, and no added hormones.
No what?
No added hormones. So we have grown quite rapidly over the years, and at this point I'm working with three ranchers in Western Oregon, Vitality Farms of Corvallis, and two up-and-coming young men, Cody Wood of Junction City and Mitch Vincent of Bandon. I'm personally retired from the active production of sheep myself, so I'm just bringing them to market for these great guys. This year they will probably produce in excess of 1,000 lambs for me. For that, they will receive a premium of about 20% over the commercial price of lamb, what they could sell to brokers. And that will mean that I get to earn a decent living and provide high-quality lamb to over 50 restaurants and other customers throughout Oregon and elsewhere. Our sales will probably be between $400,000 and $500,000 this year. And we're not the biggest. We're probably maybe third in terms of direct marketing, 100% grass-fed, hormone antibiotic-free lamb. There's two other operations that are in the millions of sales and several other smaller ones. Oregon's a great place to grow forage, and any place that's great to grow forage is a great place to grow lamb. Let me take a step back a moment and describe, you know, broadly speaking, two different kinds of ways to raise livestock. There's an industrial model that you're probably familiar with. A good example is the feedlots in northern Colorado in Grant County, where large amounts of cattle and some sheep are confined in a relatively small area. There's a huge investment in infrastructure and equipment to bring feed to these animals where they are, and they're basically stationary with very little freedom of movement, and that causes stress. So stressed animals, like stressed people, get sick. Also, a research veterinarian from University of Illinois told me a few years ago at a conference something that really crystallized it all in my head. He said the factor with the greatest correlation between livestock disease and any other is density. In other words, you know, overcrowding is going to make animals sick too. So stressed, overcrowded animals get sick. The solution in the industrial model is the routine use of antibiotics. Let me contrast that with a system where animals are not crowded together, where they have free movement to express their natural behavior. Less stress, less crowding, less disease. Maybe we don't need the antibiotics. Now, your pigs and chickens, very popular protein in the market, have simple stomachs, and they do require high-quality feed that under any system, they're not able to just go out and forage, you know, grass and other things for it. They need to have the feed brought to them. But nevertheless, they can be raised in a less dense situation. Cattle, sheep, and goats are ruminant livestock. They have a complex stomach that allows them to convert forage, plant, protein into animal, high-quality animal protein without the use of grains or any hand feeding. And they've got four legs. They can walk around and go get it themselves. So this is something that I think Oregon is well positioned to take advantage of. In the 30 years that I've been doing this, I've noticed consumers are more and more concerned about where their food comes from and that it be raised in a clean and healthy way. I think the proliferation of farmers markets and natural food stores has shown that. Even some of the large retailers like Walmart and Costco and fast food chains are now examining the raising practices of their suppliers and seeking improvement. Oregon is here to meet this need.
Let me interrupt this.
Sure.
This one. I hear the clear understanding of why there's a commercial reason for doing a natural production and why even there's a preference on the market. But I'd like to ask Dr. Noel, given this question on antibiotic resistance, tell me why you think it's a problem to provide antibiotics to chickens or to goats. I mean, what the hell difference does it make is the question.
Because bacteria really don't care where they start or where they end up. So certainly if you have give antibiotics and bathe, shall we say, the stomachs of the animals, that comes out. And the people that are handling them certainly can carry the antibiotics back to their homes and their families and spread it to the rest of the community. It is not so much that the meats can be contaminated, though some bacteria are carried on chicken, and that's why you have to cook it very well. And some of those bacteria could also be resistant and carry and be transmitted to humans. So it really comes down to bacteria can travel anywhere. And so if you get a bacteria that's resistant from an animal, it will travel to people.
It gets into the human population.
It will, yeah. That is very easy.
By contact in other ways?
I beg your pardon?
By contact in other ways.
In other ways. And this
it's
is
not so much the meat that's produced that way.
Not so much, no. No, it can be, but not so much. Certainly this is seen in areas, I'm so sorry, like India and Spain, in which they use a tremendous amount of antibiotics, and the resistance patterns there in terms of what people come in, children come in infected, it's very difficult to treat those people with the antibiotics. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Kenga.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to your question, does it get into the wastewater system as well through manure? Mm-hmm.
Bacteria can travel anywhere, yes.
I was on a panel with my friend Joshua Lederberg, I think, not with us quite anymore, a Nobel laureate in this area. And the panel was, his position was that the bugs are gaining on us. Also on the panel was one of his students who was the president of Genentech, I think, at that time, who argued that the pharmaceutical industry could produce antibiotics faster than the bugs could.
I don't think
resistant.
So.
What do you think about
that? No, the
that
bugs
one?
Are smarter. There's a lot more of them. You know, there's millions and billions and billions of them. There's only a few of us. And they will always be ahead of us. We just have to be very careful with the weapons that we give them. I did allude to this a little bit. The pharmaceutical companies, it's not their fault that they have to develop drugs for profit. And antibiotics are not a profitable drug to produce because you use it and then you stop. It's not a lifelong drug. And so for the past 10 years, there's only been one new class of antibiotics. And as opposed to the heyday in the 50s in which you had different classes of antibiotics that could go against certain bacteria, we only have one class. And it's very scary. So the pipeline, we say this in infectious diseases, the drug pipeline is dry.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Well, I expect we're going to hear more about this either here or in the Agriculture Committee or in both places.
Rep. Lively has a question.
Hmm? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lively.
Thank you. So I have this straight. So the problem isn't the antibiotics. The problem is the bacteria that's resistant to the antibiotics. So it's created by, in the case of the the farming application you were talking about, they're so close and they're stressed that they use antibiotics to try to prevent, I assume they're trying to prevent the bacteria, but it's occurring anyway because the conditions continue to go. And that creates, so the risk is that bacteria that gets carried back. But it goes back to, it's from a treatment standpoint, trying to prevent it versus trying to directly attack the bacteria once we've identified what it is. Is that correct? So in the case of the farms, I'm trying to understand. So the treatment, I assume there's antibiotics treatment from a standpoint that they know there's a bacteria or something there that they're treating, but then they're also treating to try to prevent, which creates the potential bacteria that is at risk.
Right. And, you know, there's also a factor, perhaps it wasn't anticipated, where it actually antibiotics serve a growth promotant function in livestock, in meat production. So that's, you know, that's one reason, you know, conventional livestock industry is reluctant to give that up.
I don't think anybody has a problem with the use of antibiotics in specific in a diseased animal.
Right.
Am I allowed to make one point? Something that you said really crystallized in me in terms of crowded conditions, because we certainly see this in natural disasters, sort of hearkening back to someone else, in natural disasters in which people get overcrowded and there's a breakdown in infrastructure, and the secondary cause of that is outbreaks of bacteria and disease, such as cholera and other things like that. We don't give antibiotics to prevent the secondary causes of natural disasters. We improve the infrastructure, which is very similar to what you did. So that sort of crystallized in me, in that we use antibiotics, but really specifically against an infection, not necessarily just to prevent a mass outbreak.
Thank you very much both for coming. Thank you for coming. I appreciate it.
Is it my turn?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
If I could just comment on the prevention issue.
Would you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Richard Carnevale.
Yeah, I was about to call you.
I am a veterinarian with the Animal Health Institute. We represent the animal health care companies that manufacture the medicines for animals, companion animals as well, dogs and cats and horses and aquaculture. I've been asked to come here to give you sort of an overview of where the federal government, what they're doing with regard to this issue of antimicrobial resistance. But a comment about prevention. I think antimicrobials, antibiotics used in food animals, is just one tool. I think most producers will tell you, regardless of how they're raising their animals, that that's not the only thing that they're relying on, that they have to provide good housing, they have to provide good nutrition, they have to make sure the genetics, they have to do a lot of other things. Antibiotics are not the cure-all for their problems. So it's an important tool that they need to use when infections break out, or when they need to prevent an infection they know may occur. Prevention's more important in food-producing animals because you're treating herds and flocks. You're not treating individuals. So you really need to, the failure to prevent a disease in a food-producing animal can mean loss of many, many animals, whereas in a human it may be jeopardizing one person. So it's much more important in the way antibiotics are used in food-producing animals, and it's different than human medicine. But getting back to my presentation, I'm with the Animal Health Institute. I'm also a non-voting member of the President's Council Advisory Council on Combating Antibiotic-Resistant Bacteria. Now, this is an outgrowth of the President's Action Plan. Back in 2015 or 14, President Obama issued an action plan for all federal agencies to look at how they can work within the jurisdiction of their programs to prevent and mitigate antibiotic resistance and the funding that may be needed. So after that action plan was put in place, the President organized an advisory council, and it's really a brilliant council. It's members of academia, advocacy, patient advocacy and consumer advocacy interests, pharmaceutical industry, and veterinarians. So it's veterinarians and MDs that get together and look at how the federal government can work to improve the issue of antimicrobial resistance. We understand this is a big problem. We understand that it's an international problem. The UN recently took a resolution of their members to take strong actions against antimicrobial overuse and misuse. And as was mentioned, there's a lot of misuse in underdeveloped countries, far more than there is in the U.S. and Europe because we're much more controlled systems. The FDA highly regulates these antibiotics, and I came to Oregon last year, in 2015, and talked to two committees about what the FDA was doing with regard to the issue of antibiotics used in feed. And the FDA 3 years ago decided that they were going to ask the pharmaceutical companies to eliminate the use of antibiotics, medically important antibiotics, of which there are seven that FDA has identified, for their use as growth promotion agents. And also to put the remaining antibiotics that are for prevention, treatment, and control under veterinary control, because currently they're generally over the counter, except for some exceptions. So we are now in the process of having that completed, and as we speak, the FDA is working to approve those new labels, and as of January 1st, it will be the law, no longer a voluntary program that the FDA asked the companies to engage in. Now it will be the law that the label must be followed. None of those medically important antibiotics can be used for growth promotion or can be used outside of a veterinarian's order. So that's going to be a significant change that occurs in just a couple of weeks. And, of course, that will progress throughout the next several years as they change the labels and get the industry more up to date on that. And then probably within the next year, the FDA is going to move the other products that are not used in feed or water, the injectable products, the intermammary infusions, the things that treat mastitis, or other kinds of oral medications to prescription as well. So all medically important antibiotics probably within the next 2 years will be only handled through a veterinarian's prescription. So that's an important step that the FDA is taking.
But I assume there'd be no problem from the industry in shadowing the federal statutes with the state statutes. We don't all have confidence in what's going to happen with federal regulation over the next 8 years.
Boy. Well, I can say that you know, it would be redundant for individual states to enact legislation that's essentially identical to the federal legislation
unless
that's going to happen.
The state authority to act in cases where federal authority doesn't actually do anything.
Well, that's what I'm here to tell you, is that it will be law in 2 weeks.
For now.
It will be law?
It will be illegal for anyone to use a medically important antibiotic in the feed or water of animals outside of a veterinarian's prescription or for growth promotion.
That's federal law or regulation?
Well, regulation, but it will be illegal to do that. So it will have the force of law.
Maybe. Depends on whether it's enforced.
Well, it will be enforced. Well, I can guarantee you that. It will be enforced. The FDA is very committed to this, extremely committed to this.
Yeah, and the Secretary of HHS, the incoming Secretary, is very committed to federal regulations, too.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all very much. We'll have more discussion on this as we go through. I really appreciate you all. Did you come from out of town to join us?
Yes, I did.
Thank you very much for coming here. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. I hope I can get back out of town with the storm coming, I understand.
No, I think if you get moving, you'll be fine. Don't wait till tomorrow.
All right.
Thank you very much, all three of you. I think I'd like to note for the record that we're 8 minutes early. Anybody have anything they want to waste 8 minutes with?
Yes, absolutely.
We are adjourned.
Did I get a...